You're one to talk. Take a shot.
And with that, our director, Mr. Banner, will start the meeting.
Before we move into our meeting, I'd like to say a few words. As I think you saw on the screen just before the meeting started, there was a picture of a plaque, and I attended the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies meeting last week. Commissioner Flores was also present. And at the awards banquet, I'm proud to say that the California Fish and Game Commission was identified and presented the award as Commission of the Year for 2004. It's quite an honor. There's 19 Western states in the association, 3 Canadian provinces, and the Yukon Territory. The award is presented to the commission that for the past 5 years have shown distinction in the decisions and the issues that they have worked on. And so I'm proud to present our plaque to the president of the commission, and it will be displayed in the commission office in Sacramento. That award without the support of the commission, and especially the commission's staff. They do yeoman's work to get things done, and you're only as good as the people around you. So this is an award that's shared by not only myself, but by your staff. Also, before we move into our agenda, I'd like to show a short DVD that was prepared by the state of Idaho on behalf of the Western Association. They asked for film footage from the different states and the Canadian provinces to put this video together, but It shows what fish and game agencies are all about. The people that work to protect our fish and wildlife in the West, the resources that we deal with, and I think you'll enjoy this short video. It was shown at the beginning of the conference in Idaho, but I believe Idaho Fish and Game did an excellent job in pulling all this information together. So if you bear with me for 8 minutes, I think you'll enjoy it also. Steve's trying to get the background music. This is from all over the West, not just Idaho. I think that shows a little bit of who we are. Thank you for allowing us to show you that video. Our first item this morning will be item number one. It's a public forum, and it's the item where individuals can come and ask questions of the commission or bring up issues they'd like the commission to consider. The commission then has the ability to request that the department review that request and or schedule that item for a future commission meeting. Our first speaker, and the commission policy is that we request that you make your presentation in 5 minutes or less. And there's a couple of individuals that have signed up to speak on COHO, and we're going to have you speak under the public forum item at this time. Our first speaker is Bill Nichols, followed by Don Howe, and then Bill Crum.
I guess I'm ready to go. I'm Bill Nichols. I'm the manager of Hot Creek Ranch. I'm here to ask for your help. Hot Creek, the most heavily fished 1 mile of trophy trout water in the state, is in the last stages of its life due to drought and now new minimum stream flow requirements, which permit the Mammoth Community Water District to divert water from now a new lower minimum flow requirement. I've tried through correspondence, beginning with a letter on March 21st, followed up by another letter on May 17th, and one email to the director on July 8th to have dialogue with senior fish and game management about the issue. All I've had in response is a call from an administrative assistant telling me that my material will be reviewed, and then a call from a fish and game person from Bishop telling me again that my material is being reviewed and someone will be in contact with me. Frankly, we need your help. We basically have had two people call saying they're reviewing the material, nobody getting back to me. This is a serious issue, one that I think deserves attention. More importantly, one that I think, just because of common courtesy, I should have some response. So I'm asking for the commission's help in this regard to please try and direct someone from senior fish and game management. I'm not going to use the names of the individuals who I sent the correspondence to. You have it in front of you. It's distressing to me that nobody communicates with us. We are taxpayers. We do contribute to the economy. I think it's only fair that somebody pay me the courtesy to respond to my efforts, and as you can see, those efforts I've gone into a great deal of detail to put the material together. So I'm kind of at the end of the line. I've even emailed the director saying, look, I don't like to go over somebody's head. However, what else can I do when I've sent two letters and had two people tell me someone's going to communicate with me and they haven't? And I didn't hear from the director's office either. So if you folks can give us a hand and get back to at least get the message across that we need to have dialogue. As I mentioned, Hot Creek is the most heavily fished 1 mile of water in the state. The numbers of fishermen that fish it are just incredible. And I know that there's a great deal of fishing license revenue that is generated as a result of this. and it's just beyond me that this can fall on deaf ears. I know everybody's busy. I know there are budget problems, but I also remember what we used to do in corporate America when we had budget problems. We tightened up the belt, we worked a little harder, and we got the job done. So I guess what I'm saying is I want some correspondence, and I guess I'm a little tired of hearing back that, well, so-and-so is so busy. I can remember being very, very busy working 30 years for the Marriott Corporation and up and down years and still getting the job done. So if you folks can light a fire under somebody, I sure would appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Don Howell, and today I believe I'm representing SOSS, Save Our Shasta and Scott. I'm also a director with the Siskiyou RCD. I'm going to be very brief. I gave you a handout this morning that I'd like to have included into the record. Somewhere around the first of the year, we became aware of a study that the department has been conducting, counting the streams that Brown and Moyles referred to. For Coho, that study is ongoing. We attempted to retrieve that information from the department on what the counts were, where they had been finding the fish. We ended up having to request through our attorney under the Freedom of Information Request Records Act that information. There's an attachment there from which is the response from the department staff counsel on that information. You'll see that what we ended up with to date is very little. There's a lot of information apparently out there that hasn't been quantified and hasn't been summarized, and we would request that the commission needs that information. We'd request they have the department provide that information to them and also provide the current status of that study and a summary that they may have to us. Thank you very much.
Bill Krum, followed by Virginia Hanley, and then Paul Wheatland.
My name is Bill Krum. I'm a ranch owner in the Scott Valley of Siskiyou County and a member of the Board of Directors of the Siskiyou RCD and the grassroots organization Save Our Shasta and Scott Valleys and Towns. On several occasions previously, I've had the opportunity to speak to you about the successful track record of landowners in the Scott and Shasta over the last decade and a half in improving habitat and protecting anadromous salmonids through voluntary programs executed through our RCDs, CRIMPs, and watershed councils. These efforts continue. 30 years ago, the Federal Endangered Species Act became law, with high expectations of benefit for species threatened with extinction. In the intervening 30 years, over 1,200 separate species have been designated as either threatened or endangered. But only a dozen of these have seen their situation improve to the point where they can be considered as having recovered. Thus, in 30 years, 99.9% of the listed species have not recovered. Clearly, the ESA has failed in achieving its primary objective of recovering at-risk species. This commission recognized that a different approach to achieving recovery was necessary in its approval of the voluntary Scott and Shasta and statewide Coho recovery plans. These plans explicitly recognize that since most of the habitat of the Coho is privately owned land, only a voluntary program involving active landowner participation can succeed. The regulatory and enforcement regimens typically utilized by federal and state agencies are counterproductive when implementing this type of voluntary recovery plan. Today, landowners are faced with an existing federal listing and a potential state listing. Assuming these two listings proceed at their on their own separate tracks, as they typically have done in the past, to implement any recovery plan and get necessary incidental take protection any landowner needs, it will require two separate applications, two separate environmental analyses, two separate recovery plans, two separate permits, and two separate enforcement regimens. This is process gone mad and will virtually guarantee the stifling of the voluntary landowner participation that we and others have been able to produce in the past, and is so critical to the success of a recovery plan. There is no justification or need to list the COHO at the state level. It is already federally listed. If landowners are faced with both federal and state recovery plans, ITPs, et cetera, the recovery activities will never get started. Landowners will be forced only to avoiding enforcement actions and will have little appetite or time for moving ahead with implementing the voluntary recovery plans. I would encourage the Commission to hold to the approach contained in the voluntary COHO recovery plans. Do not list the COHO, but rather insist that the Department work with NOAA Fisheries so that we can have a single successful effort to recover the COHO consistent with the recovery plans you've already approved. Thank you for your time.
Virginia Hanley, followed by Paul Weakland.
Hello, Virginia Hanley, the Fund for Animals. And I don't know if it was your choice to meet in Bridgeport, but thank you. I'd love to come to Bridgeport. I wanted to tell you about the ongoing issue of the turtles and frogs and how this is an ever evolving and developing issue. News came out of Utah where they are fighting to stop the spread of the non-Native American bullfrogs. These are animals that we import by the ton into California, that Utah is trying to keep them out of their state because of the devastating effect they have. The voracious bullfrogs are cannibalistic and can endanger their native amphibian species, which, of course, they've already impacted us in California with the red-legged frog in so many different ways. As they say in Utah, we probably can't eliminate them, but we can certainly try to contain them and stop them from spreading. I'm glad to see California working with other Western states, and I think we should get together with them on this issue as well. And do they appreciate how many bullfrogs we bring in, many, many of which are released, that we're impacting the whole Western states? They say they come from the eastern United States, grow up to 8 inches long, will eat anything they can get their mouth around, things like ducklings and fish and native frogs, which, of course, is our own our red-legged frog. They also even out-compete other species as tadpoles, that they are that strong, and that they are being spread between the lakes, springs, and ponds. So I'm asking, please, to, as, and it was a beautiful film, I love the wildlife shots there, that we work with these other states and try to help them in their efforts to protect their state from non-native species. Now we're finding in the Bay Area where I'm from, we are now importing Asian soft-shell turtles. Which probably is illegal. Does anybody stop them? We've already devastated the populations in the southeast of the United States. There are still 15,000 turtles. These are separate from the Asian softshell turtles. 15,000 turtles coming in a week to the Bay Area. 750,000 turtles a year coming in to the Bay Area. That's just what we know about in some effort of trying to figure out how much is coming in. Recently, we've had the issue of the African clawed frogs in the Golden Gate Park, and how dangerous that is, that they are non-native. There's a suspicion that tadpoles are being taken out of those ponds, and where are they going and being released elsewhere? Where did these African clawed frogs come from? Fish and Game really should investigate that. You have to have a permit to have them. There were two permits that I know of. One was UCSF that was doing research on them, and we think that they are the ones who probably released them into the ponds. That should easily be able to be found out, and that there should be prosecution for that. And also, when we just went through the whole thing with a transgenic fish, and of course research is the first one to get their exemption, and we had discussions here, I remember, well, don't worry about UCSF having these animals because they're very secure there. Well, they may be on the 14th floor somewhere, but that doesn't mean they're not going to end up down in the park or being released. We'd like you to work with the health department. There's a state regulation, people selling frogs by retail, not just pet shops. They're supposed to put up salmonella warnings. They're still supposed to put up the signs that Fish and Game has asked them to put up. None of that is happening. They're violating the state laws, the state regulations, and nothing is being done about it. And we want you to ask for a report, even from your own department, as to what are the numbers of these animals coming in, and what's the status of the situation. The attitude is, well, the horses left the barn, and, well, they're all over the place, so, well, forget it now. It's too late. Well, no, the horses continue to leave the barn, and they continue to spread, and we continue to even impact other states and their problems with non-native species. So we have a policy on that, and the one way to do it is stop them from coming in, whether they bullfrogs that are raised in the Taiwanese sewers, literally, and raised there and imported into here, coming from the wild, the turtles, now coming from the Asia as well as the Southeast. So I'd ask that you please try to ask your own department for some sort of report on this. Because it is a subject that is being ignored on all levels, and other people are struggling with this elsewhere. Thank you.
Mr. Wheatlin.
Commissioners, Paul Wheatlin. I want to correct some misconceptions in our abalone recovery management plan. Your biologists are wrong. They say that the 38,000-something sport divers are only allowed to take 24 abalones a year. This is an error. There are two free fishing days. These free fishing days, you do not have to put the abalones that you take on your abalone report card. That makes every abalone diver allowed to take 30 abalones a year. That's six more abalones than are calculated in the abalone recovery and management plan. The plan is an error. The total allowable catch is an error. And figures lie, liars figure. The other misconception is we've done extensive investigation about poaching in California. It is rampant with abalones, and the Fish and Game Commission is truly at the seat of the black market in abalones. You've allowed abalones to be imported into California. Well, this last abalone bust, and many since then, or before then, we have seen that these abalones travel to Mexico, processed and then imported back into California, our own abalones. A person that sells abalones in their restaurant takes a shipment of imported abalones. Even better yet, they say that they buy them from aquaculture, farmed fish. But what they do is they take this lading, bill of sale for these farmed abalones,
and they put it aside. And then through the back door, they take poached abalones, process them, and supply them to the public. There's a great demand, and this demand is being supplied through the black market, which the Fish and Game Commission has allowed to happen. Now, if you're a restaurant owner, you're into it for the dollars, and abalone's a big dollar maker. So what you do is you import little abalone's. You buy 10 pounds from a farm. So then you buy these poached abalone's, process them up, and as long as you only have 10 pounds of abalone in your establishment any one time, your little bill of sale from aquaculture shows that you paid for 10 pounds of abalone meat. This is how the black market abalone continues to thrive in California, something that the Fish and Game has not tried to do anything about. I have handouts here to show that the importation of fish from Mexico is not a good idea, and that the only way that the Fish and Game ever is able to take on these large poaching rings is by snitches who rat off the illegal abalone guard. And the people that are telling the Fish and Game about these illegal activities are other divers. The more divers you have out in the water, the more chances you have of catching these large poaching rings. Unfortunately, a great many of your sport divers know of this black market affair and are able to support themselves off of selling one or two of their abalones that they take. This poaching is what has stimulated a lot of people to say, oh no, the abalone management is perfect just the way it is. We're making a lot of money through the black market, see. And these importation of abalones, we're importing our own abalones back into California after they've been poached and taken out. It's disgrace. That is all.
Our next agenda item is a presentation by the Friends of Sierra regarding the study to reduce mortality on bait caught and release trout, and then also the Water for Wildlife program. Our first speaker will be Dick Knowles, followed by E.J. Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Director. I have made a presentation before this board on a couple of occasions for the last 8 years. Volunteers in Inyo and Mono County started a program to, as a conservation of our trout resource, we determined that there had to be a better way to release bait-caught trout. We know that fly fishing community does it, and we were accused on many occasions of killing more fish than we caught and kept and turned loose, and we realized that. And it's important that we establish a program that might, if we could prove it, might help anglers release trout. One of the things that's going on is the travelers that come here in one of the most beautiful trout fishing areas in the country catch and throw back fish, probably far more than fly fishing activity, but their release methods are killing the resource. So what we did, a group of us got together, thanks to the Department of Fish and Game. We worked with Steve Parmenter, their wild trout biologist, and for the last 8 years have worked on a project that we hoped would show results. And I have given you a handout, and that is the result of that study. We went for grant funding, and we were successful in getting a $25,000 grant from the Forest Service. And thanks to their help and the other supporters, we spent over $60,000 on this report. The Department of Fish and Game, the Forest Service, Inyo County, Mono County, Town of Mammoth Lake, City of Bishop, all the Chambers of Commerce worked with us, and the study was done at the June Lake Marina, Alpers Trophy Trout Hatchery. We had excellent cooperation from everyone on this because we all realize that it's important that we do something to reduce the mortality of this very important resource to our economy and to the enjoyment of all fishermen. The committee was made up of the Sierra Trout Committee. Friends of Sierra Trout was the John Fredrickson from the June Lake Marina, Steve Marty from the Lower Twin Lakes Resort, Emil Rummel from the Mammoth Lake Sports Fishing Association, and Bill Wright from the Big Pine Chamber, who represented the Chambers of Commerce because of the economic value that we were dealing with here.
what we have developed and what has been the result of Dr. Tom Jenkins's report. It has been peer-reviewed and has been published in the North American Fisheries Management Journal. And if you were to take the time to look at this, you would see that the methods that were used, there is some new technology that you're looking at that was brought forth. The results of releasing a trout without leaving the hook in the mouth is a great advantage, of course. And this Shelton hook was brought to us. We said we'd use a boat anchor if it would save trout. And they brought this hook to us. We used the Circle C hook. And the statistics have shown that a 50% given was probably what bait anglers were doing to release their fish. And this study has shown that bait anglers with a simple method of release, and it will be described to you by some of the other fellows here, that we can reduce the mortality from 50% down to 5%, 6%, and less. It's an incredible method, and it's simple, and we're educating people to do that. And we are very proud of what we've done here in Inyo Mono County. We think that this is in fact, Dr. Jenkins said that this document now is a worldwide document. I would suggest to you that when you're looking at fishing regulations and things that can be done, education-wise, even when you're looking at updating sport fishing regulations on the Upper Owens River, you need to look at this and decide if this isn't an appropriate method and can be taught so that we can get everybody back fishing again. We really appreciate the times we've had with you to talk to you about this. We're excited about it, and it's being developed and being pushed really hard here. And I will let the floor go to other folks that want to talk to you about it. But thank you for your support and to all these agencies and your Department of Fish and Game, because we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramo, followed by Mr. Wright.
It's an honor to be in front of the number one commissioner in California. Welcome to Bridgeport. My name is Emil Rummel. I go by E.J. Rummel because my first name is difficult to pronounce. I'm a Mono County Fisheries Commissioner. I'm president of the Mammoth Lake Sport Fishing Association. And also, I'm involved with a group to partner with the Hot Creek Hatchery in Mono County. I'm just here as a continuation of Dick Knowles, who just spoke before you. And my portion of it is basically to make sure that this little item here is sent to practically anyone who is interested in vacationing in the Eastern Sierras. We make sure that all the brochures have this particular item. And you've seen it before you, and I don't need to go into details about it. 2 weeks ago, Mammoth Lakes held a children fishing festival. We have been doing this for 14 years. We're trying to educate the youth of tomorrow about conservation with bait hook. And this is a marvelous study that's been done, and I'm part of the group, as I just mentioned, that Dick is involved for the last 8 years. We've been very successful in it, and we will continue to do that. Thank you.
William Wright, followed by Rob Lasardi.
Thank you very much. My name is William E. Wright. I am here as a member of the Friends of Sierra Trout. I am also representing the Big Pine Chamber of Commerce and the Coalition of Chambers for Inyo County. I am also a present member, commissioner of the Inyo and Mono Fish and Game Advisory Commission. And I also want to welcome you to Inyo County. What we have done on this, we've pushed this pretty hard. We've gotten we got a lot of money from our commissions, from our chambers, and the different people to push this. I have made 3 presentations through the Forest Service to the campground host. What we were hearing was that a lot of perfectly fine trout were being thrown into Dempsey dumpsters and trash cans throughout the campgrounds and things. So we did a little investigation. This is one of the things that have come with it. And what we're trying to do, we would like to have this put in the California State Fishing Regulations, because we think this would not only help us, but it would help every small county or in California that has trout fishing. And it's a very wonderful thing, very simple. I have handouts here as one is marked with the study so that you can read it. This is the Eastern Sierra Fishing Guide. And, of course, I also handed out the Big Pine Chambers Visitor's Guide. We really feel that this could be a real economic benefit to them, and that's people who go up there and catch fish, and then they throw them away. We have the wonderful people who go up and catch fish, and then they want to give them away. Well, if they're catching fish real easy, so is everybody else in the campground, so they're not able to give them to people. And some people who don't have a license or are reluctant to take them. But if we can push this, and at our derbies, we've been pushing at all of our fish derbies here, to try to get this to increase the number of trout in our system. And it's basically to protect our resources and make fishing a better thing for all of us. I have one of the Sheldon hooks here. We did a lot of barbless hooks. Come up here, John. We did a lot of the barbless hook studies. This was only one of them. And I'll get John to help me demo this. I'm using just the Sheldon on this time. The barbless hooks were pretty evident. We had about 95% or better survival with this hook. I'll be honest with you, I fished these streams since I was 8 years old in Inyo-Imoto County, and I was a little optimistic of this, but these guys convinced me it was great. You pull on it here, and
fish is hooked now, and then you just take the
no matter where even if you can't see the hook, okay, it'll come right out. So this is some of the stuff we've done. Dr. Jenkins did a wonderful job on this study, and we had a lot of people, and we've had a lot of money and time from our chambers, our Lions clubs, our different community areas that promote fishing, and we would really like to have your support on this. If we could get it in the fishing game regulations, I think you could help everybody in the state. Any questions?
Rob Lissardi, yeah. Followed by Paul Weakland.
Paul Pass.
Oh, okay. Paul Weakland.
Commissioner, it's Paul Weakland. I did, like the President, Mr. Kellogg, said, and went around California and I talked to a lot of fishermen. And there are a great consensus that this catch-and-release program is a fallacy. You injure these fish to a point where they aren't able to eat, they aren't able to survive, they get weakened, and you're as much as sentencing them to death when you release them. Now, a real sportsman, he wants to catch a fish and eat it. Well, he should be able to catch a fish and take it home and eat it. Why not? But the greedy guy that wants this stimulated cigarette, I caught a fish. Oh, I caught 40 fish today, and I released them all. Well, out of those, probably 39 are going to die, huh? So what kind of a sporting thing is that? The other deal is these hatcheries, this artificial propagation. You artificially propagate these fish to spawn. You're creating a hybrid fish in a way that your biologists don't want to recognize. We know that there is a mechanism in nature that when there's too much genetic diversity present, it negates all spawning and creates an acid atmosphere in the waters. And fish die, great mortalities. We have great fish die-offs because of this mechanism that nature's trying to cleanse or purify itself from these genetic hybrids. But no one wants to acknowledge this. And even though it was mentioned in scientific papers clear back in 1984, no explanation is ever given of why this is not included in your scientific documents. The other thing is, catch and release is good if you're using hatchery fish, because there are people that have eaten these hatchery fish and become sick. So, you know, catch and release on these hatchery fish makes sense because you don't want them to be eaten. The other thing is, when you hook into a hatchery fish, oh my, I got a fish. Yes, you know you do. And you bring it in, and you don't want to eat it because you know it came from a hatchery. When you catch a wild fish, my God, yeah, the fight is on. I know this didn't come from a hatchery. Now, that's what the true sportsmen want. Thank you.
Can
Now we'll move into the Water for Wildlife program.
May I add something on to that? I'm sorry I didn't put down that I would speak on this. But, well, I was at the last Fish and Game Commission meeting in Crescent City, and a woman gave a very impassioned talk about the catch and release. And I spoke to her afterwards because I'd always wanted to believe in catch and release and support it. And she told me afterwards that she thought that about 80% of them died. And she really gave heartbreaking stories of her trying to resuscitate these fish, trying to save their lives to have them to back in, trying to save fish that other people had caught and released. And she's trying to mouth to mouth, or pumping their little hearts, trying to get them to go. That was very heartbreaking. So if there's a new kind of hook that can help with this, I think it's a wonderful thing to happen, and that if it's something that needs to go into the fishing regulations to support it, then I hope that that will be done.
Is there more than one manufacturer of this hook?
At this time, I have no reason to believe there isn't another one, but I don't know.
Okay.
My business was not to sell a hook. My business was to save a fish. So I'm
right.
Really not into who's. I know that Circle C are on the market. The Shelton self-releasing could be manufactured by other people at this time. I don't know.
So
it's not incredible.
It's not patented?
The Shelton hook is patented. As far as I know. But other people may be doing other things with it. But it is an incredible hook.
I mean, it seems like a good idea to think about requiring it. My only concern would be that if you require a particular piece of gear that's only manufactured by one manufacturer and they hold the patent, then in effect we're creating a monopoly. And it's you know. Well, but if it's patented, they'd have to license it. Right? So I think there are probably some issues to explore.
Well, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. All we wanted to do was save fish, and I think we did it.
We had all kinds of harvests, not just that.
I am going to move on then to the Water for Wildlife program. For the last 15 years, volunteers, I've been responsible, if you will, for as a volunteer, not representing any organization, but responsible for the installation, acquiring material, funding to install Water for Wildlife in Inyo and Mono County. We have 23 of these systems in operation right now, and we started out 15 years ago because the animals, Dr. Blyke, who has been working with us continually on this program, did a study back in the late 80s, to show us in the Inyo Mountains where our mule deer population was and where it was going. And the water source that they had was basically one, and that was called Side Hill Spring. And the deer with the collared deer were traveling for miles to get to water, to this one source. And so my youngest son and I decided one day when we were back there hunting, why don't we do something about this? Why don't we put some water where the deer are going? And we had looked at the maps, and it was like a fan. If you can visualize a wide fan and the water system being at the base of that fan, the deer were not going south down the Inyo Mountain Range. They were going north and west and some of them east. And they were traveling for miles. And the collars showed they were literally going miles. And so we started a program with the Mule Deer Foundation, the California Deer Association. We had support from five times Edison Company, power company, donated a helicopter to fly units in. We had contractors, everybody in town, Edison Company, DWP, E. Brown Supply, everybody in the community donated and helped us with this and funded the project. And we ended up with about a little over $70,000 in the last 15 years installing these units. The last four went in last summer. And the wildlife response to these is incredible. And what you're seeing there is a group of individuals. That's part of over 100 volunteers that I had that worked for us on this project. It's an incredible program.
The animals that you see, the birds, are on a unit that is 15 years old and still going great guns. In fact, that unit, we have to add some more water, because when you add water in the desert environment, you have the animals respond, and you have to have literally more water than you have animals. When you first start, you end up with less water, and you have to haul a little. But I think we've swung the pendulum in our favor, and we're not having to haul. We haven't had to haul water this year at all, even though it's a drought situation. And we have the doves, the chuckers, the mule deer, the bobcats, the coyotes, anything you can imagine in the desert environment have responded to these. And this has been a volunteer effort, and without the support of your organization, the Forest Service, the Fish and Game, the Bureau of Land Management, and an incredible number of volunteers and their personal time, their personal trucks, their personal gas to get there, and the hard work. It takes about roughly, we can install one of those units. I think the longest was 6 hours, and takes about, on the average, about 4.5 hours for us to completely install the satellite dishes that are donated by utilities, 1,000-gallon tank, the drinker system, fill it, and drive away. We can have a unit done in about that length of time. But interestingly, getting ready for it through the environmental work that has to be done with the permit process, the environmental assessment that has to be done, it takes almost 20 to 24 months just to do a 3.5-hour job. But we're pretty proud of what we've done, and the wildlife has responded incredibly. And again, we thank the Fish and Game. I have kind of backed out of it. I don't pull that wagon anymore. I've decided it's time for the younger generation. 15 years was enough for me, although I do support it. But I just wanted to report to you that there's been an incredible bunch of volunteer stuff going on. And by the way, that is in the forest plan. The Forest Service has this in their forest plan to install water. We have kind of taken it on as a volunteer effort. And BLM also, we've done that. So I just thought you'd like to know that there's some really great volunteer stuff going on the forest, working with wildlife, and we're way over here on this side of the mountain, but there's a lot of fun things going on, and I do appreciate your time. I really do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knowles. Mr. Doug Brown.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Doug Brown. I'm here representing the California Deer Association, the Eastern Sierra Chapter. We're taking over the Guzzler projects that Dick's been involved with for 15 years, and we'd like to thank him for all the stuff that he's done so far. We're working right now on 4 new Guzzler projects that are in the planning stages right now. The Forest Service is doing all their paperwork, all the stuff that takes so long. Anyway, they're in the stages right now. We've got 4 of them. The funding is taking place, so hopefully we'll get 2 of them in before the snow flies this year, and then probably a couple more in the spring. They're going in the Inyo and White Mountains, where the arid regions where we don't have any water. And we're working closely with Elisa Ellsworth. She's the biologist for that region, and she's been real good to work with. And I also wanted to let you know that the California Deer Association has donated $74,500 to a deer study. I'm sure you guys approved it all, but to the study in the Inyo and White Mountains. So that's all. Thank you.
I want to make a quick comment. Do you notice how much younger he looks than I do? That's why I quit. I need young people to do this.
I'd just like to say that on both of these issues, the hooking study and the Water for Wildlife program, organizations over here on the east side have done excellent work on both of those programs. And the commissioners have been provided with a copy of the scientific study that was done on the hooking mortality issue. And you know, I just can't say enough for organizations that volunteer and do this good work. So thank you. Our next item is item 3, and it's a presentation by the Eastern Sierra Quail Unlimited regarding their chapter's habitat improvement project of modifying existing water guzzlers on BLM and Forest Service land into water drinking systems. Mr. Rick Fields is here, Vice Chairman of the Eastern Sierra Quail Unlimited, that will be making the presentation. And before he begins, Mr. Peterson and McFall, I haven't forgotten you. I've put your cards in on the Owens River item, and I understand there's other issues you'd like to talk about, and we'll let you do that under item four. Mr. Fields.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You have before you a copy of the report that I provided for you earlier. On behalf of the Eastern Sierra Quail Unlimited chapter, I want to thank the Commission for allowing us to come before you today and let you know what we're doing to enhance the overall habitat in Inyo and Mono counties through a modification of existing guzzlers. Quail Unlimited is a national nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation and development of wildlife habitat. And what we have done since we started our chapter back in 2001 is to primarily identify existing guzzlers that were put in during the 1950s and 1960s by different organizations. And although the concept was good, the idea was good, the engineering was bad, the way these guzzlers were put in. It's basically like a 10-meter diameter apron, cement apron, which collects water through natural rainfall, of which we have very little where we're located. And it drains into a 600-gallon tank, fiberglass tank that's placed into the ground, covered with cement, and it has an access to it that can be used to add water or to clean out the tank. In partner with the DFG, BLM, and the Forest Service, Death Valley National Park, U.S. Geological Service, and the University of Reno, Nevada, we have dedicated ourselves to improving the habitat for our wildlife in Inyo and Mono County. And we have identified and surveyed 36 guzzlers to date, and looking back in the 1950s and 1960s. And through the coordination with the BLM and the Forest Service, which controls most of the land around Inyo and Mono County, we have gone in and through the help of Dick Knowles, Mr. Knowles showed us how to modify an existing guzzler and make it useful for all wildlife to enjoy. And if you'll look at page 2 of the guzzler, where it says guzzler modification, I've put some pictures for you to show you step by step what we do to turn the existing guzzler into a wildlife drinking system. First thing we do is clean off the existing cement apron, clear off any vegetation that has accumulated around that would go down into the small slit that was placed in the original guzzler. It's only about, I don't know if you're familiar with the old guzzlers, but they're about, it's about a 6-inch slit, about 3 or 4 feet across, and very small animals can get into it, but that's about it. Any large animals cannot benefit from that particular type of configuration. So what we've done is dig out from behind the guzzler, dig down to the bottom of it, of the 600-gallon tank, get down below it, and then we tap that. We drill a hole in the bottom, dig a big trench 30 to 40 yards long that's about 2 feet across, about 3 to 5 feet deep, and we drain all that bad water out. And I say bad water because when we go in there and clean out the tank, we find skeletons, we find skulls of small animals, and No one has maintained these guzzlers since they've been put in, obviously, because of what we've found. The little water that we do find in there is contaminated with botulism and so forth, and it's not suitable for any type of animal to drink out of. So we clean out the tank. We drill a hole in the bottom. We drain it out. We clean it out real good. We purify it, and then we connect a PVC pipe to the bottom of the existing tank, the 600-gallon tank. We run it down the length of the trench, about 30 to 40 yards, and we connect it to a smaller 55-gallon drum. And on the outside of the 55-gallon drum is a drinking tray that makes it available for all wildlife to take advantage of, including deer, chukar, whatever. Then we fill in the trench after we hook it up. We put a float valve in the 55-gallon drum, the smaller drum, to control the water level, which flows down from the larger tank. We fill the new tank with water. We open the valve. The water goes into the smaller 55-gallon tank, and the little water tray fills up, and that's about it. It's a simple procedure. It takes us about, unlike Dick Knowles, it takes us about 6 hours to do it because digging those trenches takes a little longer when you run into rocks and so forth. But so far we have been able, out of the 36 guzzlers we've identified in Inyo and Mono County, we have converted 7 of those into wildlife drinking systems. So we have our job ahead of us here to continue the good job. I'm not here to ask you for anything. I'm just here to make you aware that we are out there volunteering our time and efforts to improve the habitat. And we've also instituted an Adopt-a-Guzzler program. Once we do the maintenance and get the wildlife drinking system in place, we ask for volunteers from our Quail Unlimited chapter to go out and periodically check every 2 or 3 months to make sure that there's still water in these guzzlers, make sure that it's clean, make sure that no damage has been done. If there is, then we'll take action to make sure that it's corrected. And with a good maintenance system in effect, we will ensure that there's water there for our wildlife to enjoy and enhance the future populations. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Weakland.
Commissioner Paul Weakland. I'm very familiar with the gallinaceous guzzlers. They were designed for gallinaceous birds and small creatures in that manner. To now open them up to larger animals will be, I don't know what you'd say, contradictory to the first and foremost plan of the gallinaceous guzzlers, only to allow the small creatures to drink from them. There are reservations in the beginning. I am responsible myself for participating in the installation of 9 gallinaceous guzzlers. And at the time, reservations were sounded that we are messing up the natural ecology of the area, that we are fooling and fiddling with Mother Nature, and the ecology of the area is being dramatically changed by these concepts. And before the gallinaceous guzzlers were ever input, they had a large environmental study done, and I don't believe this is being done before the modification. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next item is item 4, and it's an update on sport fishing regulations for the Upper Owens River. This report was requested by Commissioner Flores when the Commission adopted its 2004 to 2006 sport fishing regulations in December. The Commission has received public comments on the Upper Owens River regulations probably over the last 4 to 6 years. So this will be an update on the existing sport fishing regulations. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Ed Pert, who will provide some background, and then I believe the department also has a short presentation on the regulations, and then we'll open it up to public comments.
Yeah, good morning, commissioners and staff. I just wanted to thank you for allowing us to revisit this issue here in this venue so that we can all hear from the constituents and give the commission background on this information. I'm not sure that some of the commissioners have had the background, you've all had the same background on this. So we appreciate this opportunity. We have Curtis Milliron, who's the regional fisheries biologist here, who's been working on this issue for probably close to 20 years. And he's going to give a brief presentation, which will give you an overview on this river and also the department's perspective. And then we'll be happy to hear from the various constituencies who do have divergent views on this issue. So with that, Curtis Milliron.
Good morning. My name is Curtis Milliron, and I've been in the Eastern Sierras for about 17 years, almost, and with the department about 20. When I first got here, I took over the management of Crowley and the tributaries to Crowley, and since that time, we've done quite a few studies on the performance of the fisheries as well as the tributary fisheries. And so we're going to focus now on the Upper Owens River, and this is very much the same talk as I gave earlier back in December to the commission, but we're going to revisit the reason why the department has proposed the regulations that were initially in place before the recent closure of what we call Section 2. Just waiting for the PowerPoint to come up. I will say, as part of the studies that we did, we found out that catch and release, kind of referring back to an earlier topic, for bait anglers, was actually quite a bit higher than I had ever anticipated. It was somewhere in the range of 40 to 50% of the fish caught on bait were being released, and I really hadn't figured it would be that high. Certainly, other methods are more commonly used for catching and releasing, but that was an eye-opener for us. I'll go ahead and start the gist of the conversation. Really, this is Upper Owens River is a traditional fishery. It's been so many people have started their angling careers fishing on the Upper Owens River. The first slide that hopefully will come up talks about, here we go, shows just the kind of intensity that this river, this section of river, has had over the years. Literally thousands of angler hours every opening day, opening weekend, and opening month are spent. There's a historic picture probably from about the 1970s, 1980, somewhere in there, I would guess by that pickup truck. But that's the kind of thing that we used to see, and up until the closure, that's the kind of activity that you would expect to see on the Upper Owens River on opening day. It's very intense. It's a traditional fishery. There is a campground that I think Earl Brown is here, and I imagine he'll talk about his campground and how this regulation has impacted that. As far as new information since this last time we've talked, flying the Upper Owens River on opening day this year was quite an eye-opener for me. I've done that many times. We fly Crowley and get a pressure count, get an idea of how many anglers are actually fishing Crowley Reservoir at any given time on opening morning, and then we use that pressure count to figure out a harvest for the resource. But we also fly the Upper Owens River, and we've done that for many years. In the past, I would expect to see approximately 200 or 300 anglers fishing the Upper Owens River on each flyby. This year, 15 or 20. And what's really startling about that is that we've only closed about 3.5 miles of the river. There's still 16 miles of the river that are open, but the effect of that closure has spread out across all three sections that we'll talk about. So which do I... One of the objectives that we established for the Upper Owens River and the other tributaries that we wanted to make angling quality good enough to where the average angler that was fishing the river had the opportunity to catch a fish greater than 16 inches at a rate of about one a day. That was our goal. That still remains our goal, and there are ways to achieve that goal. But what I want to discuss today is that the closure of Section 2 of the Upper Irwin's River is not one of those ways. We know quite a bit about the fishery in the Upper Owens and the Crowley River system. This is a weir structure that we operated for 3 years in the early 90s. And we, along with a marking program where we marked literally all of the fish, we had over 200 volunteers. Kel Trout was of great help in this regard. They organized a lot of volunteer effort. We marked 500,000 fish a year for many years, and then we followed them as they were caught in the reservoir or as they migrated up past this weir structure. And this weir would catch fish in either an upstream or a downstream direction. We operated it under the most adverse conditions, and many times we couldn't operate it because those conditions got the better of us. The point of this is that even through all this, with our effort, much effort as we put forth, we probably sampled somewhere into the zone of somewhere around 10 to 20% of the fish that passed this weir. Because it was during these high flow events that we know that many fish move, and they tend to congregate with an increase in flow. They tend to move upstream, just like salmon or steelhead would do. And yet during that period of time, we caught over 5,000 fish in those 3 years. This is a summary of the data that we saw past that weir. The top This is the rainbow trout that were caught. These are the brown trout, and we also track Sacramento or Owen suckers. The black bars show fish as they go upstream, and the hatched bars show fish as they come downstream in that direction. So you see that rainbow trout have quite a large spring spawn, and they do run up the river. They also then come back down. What is also interesting about this system is that we have a fall spawn of rainbow trout, and you see that these are fall-running rainbow trout. That's quite unusual for the species. And so these hatched bars that you see here and here are actually these fall fish returning. What's interesting about that is that these fall fish here are really 100% wild fish. And we know that because we had marked all of the hatchery fish. There were no marks represented in those fall running fish. However, these spring fish were almost entirely hatchery fish. And a lot of the discussion that has gone on about the regulations on the Upper Owens River are in regards to what about all these spring running fish that we see. Those spring running fish were put in the August before, for the most part. And so those are hatchery fish. They're primarily Kamloops rainbow trout. They come from Junction Reservoir historically, and recently they've come from Black Rock Hatchery. And the reason why I bring that up is because the change from Junction Reservoir to Black Rock Hatchery has seemingly changed the performance of these fish as well. And that is something that we will be monitoring this in next year. But the point here is that as people catch these fish in the river, this large run of rainbow trout, and they're generally about in the 14 to 15 or 16 inch size, that they're thinking that these are wild fish, that they're sacred, that they should be protected. These are the same fish that the anglers in Crowley are catching by the thousands. These are the same fish that we put in the river or in the lake the August before, and that have grown in the reservoir, in this system, and now are just, because they're a 2-year-old or older fish, they're running up the tributaries. If we didn't put them in the year before, they wouldn't be there. That's not the same as these fall running fish. Those are wild fish, and those are a very spectacular rainbow trout. Brown trout are fall running fish, and you see that they can run starting in about July, and then they start returning in the fall. This is December here. The fish that we saw past that weir were mostly over 16 inches. They are mostly the wild fish that were in the system. You see, these are the rainbow trout, and what I'd like to point out here is that we saw almost 3,000 rainbow trout over the course of 3 years. And again, we couldn't operate that weir when the flow changes put us out of business. Fish moved during those flow changes. I tried to operate the weir one time during a flow event, a storming event, and the water came up, and one of those pictures showed that event. We caught within about 4 hours, and with the weir half dismantled, we caught like 20 times more fish than we caught the previous month on any given day. Fish really do move when the flow goes. These are the brown trout. We caught over 2,500 of them. There's the figure right there. And again, All of these fish from here over are over 16 inches. Okay, now looking at the regulations that resulted from this work, you have Crowley and a set of regulations, a number of other tributaries that we have special regulations on, and then the Upper Owens River system. The entire green section here is managed for catch and release. Much of that is not available to anglers because it's within private ranch holdings, but a good portion of it is within the public domain, or it's within public waters, and the anglers do use those pretty heavily. Then, so this is, we call this Section 3, from the Benton Bridge Road crossing up to Highway 395. The black dot represents a monument that was placed that we regulate from the monument downstream to Crowley the same as Crowley. So that's important because in the fall, or after August 1st, Crowley goes to a two fish limit, 18 inch minimum size. So you have a catch and release regulation. That approximately in the fall, you have over a mile of stream or river habitat that is managed for catch and release. That's from August 1st through the end of the season. As wild fish in the fall congregate in that lower section of river, they are already afforded protection from that regulation. So really now, it's just this little zone of water right here that we're haggling over, and we've called that the gauntlet. And it's called the gauntlet because in order for wild fish to get up into this catch and release area and a lot of good water to spawn in, they've got to get past what we had regulated before as a general district regulation, five fish limit, no special gear restrictions, bait is okay. So we wanted to know, well, were we really making a mistake there? And so we intensively monitored that fishery for 2 years. I had a full-time employee, he was a scientific aide. He was on the river for 40 hours a week for 6 months during the entire season. We did pressure counts four times a day, or at least three times a day. He ran the entire open the public section of the river and counted the number of anglers in each section. And then he interviewed the rest of the day those anglers to find out what is the average catch, what kind of success were people having. And then we used that data and estimated a harvest for those days, and then we extrapolated over the course of the days that we weren't there. During the really heavy periods of time, like opening weekend, we had up to seven or eight folks on the river, and we were interviewing more intensively and capturing data more intensively. So here's why we want to maintain the regulation structure that we put in. In essence, the fish that we're concerned about, the fish greater than 16 inches, the fish that went past that weir, that 5,000 fish that we saw, the most of them, they were not being harvested in the system. Over the course of the entire season, and I don't need that. You see that opening day alone accounted for most of the harvest of big fish. And this is fish over 16 inches. In this case, it's all fish, both rainbow trout and brown trout. This is the total for the season in 1996. So opening day was the biggest single take. And in fact, it was the first couple hours of opening day that was the biggest single take. And that's where you have larger fish loitering in some of the bigger holes, and they're easy targets. Make opening day any day you want, you're probably going to have that harvest. And then it tapered on down very quickly. And then in the fall, it came up a little bit. But the total number here is very small, 274 rainbow trout over 16 inches harvested. Compared that to the thousands of fish that we saw in the system, it seems very insignificant. The 92 brown trout over 16 inches. This is in 1997. The totals look very much the same, similar patterns. It amounts to a total of 400 fish over 16 inches were harvested. And that's over the entire season in all three sections. So in a summary here, what we looked at next was, okay, well, how does this regulation make a change to the use of this area? And I want to modify this when I'm done describing what we have here. So we looked at, okay, well, we have bait anglers on opening weekend. We have the rest of May and then in October. And this was not adjusted to take into account that the season has been extended to the middle of November. We looked at how many fish were actually harvested during those periods of time, and that's these numbers here. And we looked at how many angler hours by each angling group was applied. Then I made the following analysis. There are over 10,000 hours of bybait anglers, 1,600 hours, and I assumed that half of the lure anglers would be displaced, that they would not continue to fish the Upper Owens River. We came up with an estimate of almost 12,000 hours of angling effort, and for that we would save 170 fish. I now want to modify that and say that that 12,000 hours is probably grossly understated. And the reason for that is the observations that we've been making since that section has been closed. That the campground facility that was there was probably providing camping facilities for an array of angler types. And the families might go there. The kids might fish in section two, where the better anglers might go try their hand at catch and release waters. The bottom line is that it's an underestimate. It's a lot of hours that we're not. It's a lot of hours that are being either displaced, and then I have to question as a traditional place for people to come and fish, and anglers are traditionalists, and it's not that the department doesn't buck tradition when we have the scientific evidence to do so and manage for a higher quality fishery when there's evidence and reason to do so. But in this case, we're not really saving the fish that we're arguing about. Instead, we're either displacing or perhaps eliminating a good portion of anglers that might come to the Eastern Sierras or even buy fishing licenses. And I want to finish on a more important note, and this is where we finished last time, is that the Upper Owens River has a serious set of problems, and that's why there is contention. Those problems are environmentally based for the most part. It also has to do with what we do in our hatcheries. If we don't stock those Kamloops rainbow trout, or if they've now adjusted or changed their behavior because we've taken them to a different facility and they're spawning 2 months earlier and there's changes, then those changes are going to manifest into a different behavior, and anglers are going to say, something's wrong, something's changed. It has changed, whether it's wrong or not. We need to do more study on that, and we are doing that. In fact, one of the things we're doing for the Kamloops is we're going back to Junction Reservoir. We've taken eggs from there this year, and we're going to stock Junction Kamloops fish next year. So the following year, we should see a return back to that other type of performance. But the real big issue on the Upper Owens River is water quality. The Upper Owens River often gets to temperatures near 80 degrees. And anybody that fishes for trout knows that 80 degrees is not very good trout water. High 70s are very common this time of the year. There is an opportunity, and Caltrout has been very proactive in this regard, to help modify these temperatures by getting Mono Basin water delivered to the Upper Owens River at a time when the temperatures are highest. So there is a certain amount of Mono Basin water that is exported to the Upper Owens River. Unfortunately, in the past, it's been exported during a time when it wouldn't help out on that temperature problem. So we're trying to fix that. And that came up first in the Mono Basin water right hearings. It just never made it into the implementation of the water delivery scheme until now when we're working on it. And then another unfortunate incident is this year has been a drought year. So the amount of export of Mono Basin water is very much tied and dependent upon what kind of water year we get. But therein lies a much better answer to this problem. Thank you.
Any questions or comments?
Thank you, Curtis. Rob Lasardi, followed by Kevin Peterson.
My name's Rob Lasardi. I work for California Trout. I just want to provide an alternative opinion. There are definitely severe temperature issues on the Upper Owens River. There's no doubt. Fish and Game has done studies. California Trout has done studies. And this year, we pretty much had an agreement with the Department of Water and Power to release between 100 and 150 CFS into the Upper Owens River from the West Portal, but due to the drought year and low Grant Lake elevations, that wasn't going to happen. But what is going on is there is a lot of pressure and stress on these fish due to temperature regimes. There's no doubt about that. The 1997 Crawley Management Plan clearly states as one of the main management goals and objectives that they would like to provide the opportunity to catch trophy-sized trout greater than 16 inches on the Crawley tributaries at a median rate of at least one fish per angling day. To my knowledge, that has not occurred, the latest data that I've seen. And the management direction until they reach that is if the goals are not being met, modification will be recommended based on resource protection first with allowable use as a secondary objective. For these reasons, we strongly believe that the area of river from Benton Crossing down to the fishing monument should remain closed during spawning for rainbows in the spring to the Saturday preceding Memorial Day, and then again from September 30th on for spawning brown trout populations. Just in the spring population, I didn't quite get the numbers. I think it was 10 to 20% were sampled, and I'm wondering if this is really representative of the entire rainbow population. I have a very difficult time believing that wild rainbows are not going up the Upper Owens River in the spring, or a majority in a large population are not going up the Upper Owens River in the spring to spawn. And we believe these regulations should stay in place and that this discussion ideally will be run in about 2.5 years in the normal regulation cycle. Thanks.
Thank you. Kevin Peterson, followed by Brad McFall.
Director Traynor, Commissioners, thank you for allowing us this forum. I'd like to speak to you a bit about some current data that I have. I am my name's Kevin Peterson. I'm co-owner of the Trout Fly and Trout Fitter, two fishing stores in Mammoth, fly fishing as well as bait, every kind of fishing that we do here. Mr. Milliron continues to give you data from 1997 back. I continually bring you fresh and updated data from the guidebooks of 12 guides. The Upper Owens River, from the time that the regulations were put in place to kill the spawning fish, continually dropped to a devastating level. We went from 30-day average of guiding there to 3 during those regulations. After the regulations were changed back to protect the spawning fish, we have seen them gone back. Well, from the 12 guides in our association, we've fished over 80 days this year on the Upper Owens River, showing you that we don't take guide trips to where there aren't fish. The fishing has gotten continually better to the point to where it is almost back to where it was prior to what we call the bad regulations. We are taking an average of 6 people or 6 trips a week there now. The fishing is as good as it's been in many, many years. And again, the data that Mr. Milliron continues to give you is prior to 1997, and we're on the water every day. This is where we fish, and I'm telling you, the fishing has improved immensely. I really appreciate your foresight in putting these regulations in place, and I ask that you keep them there. Really important. One of the things that I do agree with Curtis on is that we do have some serious water issues there as far as temperature. We have a lot of things that are going on that certainly need to be studied. I would appreciate any studies that could be done on that Upper Owens River. I also am getting growing increasingly concerned about Mr. Milliron's, who is a state biology, his concerns for the well-being of Earl Brown's campground. I'm not really sure what that relationship is, but I'm starting to wonder about that. I think that his job is to take care of our fisheries. Thank you very much. Oh, I do have one other thing to say. On the stocking programs, we're seeing a decrease in stocking because of our state budget cuts, and there are a lot of areas in our area, like the San Joaquin River, that are getting our wild fish populations are being decimated because of the lack of stocking there. San Joaquin River, in particular, has had zero stocking this year. It's a lot of campgrounds there. People are used to catching and killing fish. These people come up every year, and there is a zero stock this year, and we're seeing people walk around with stringers of dead little 5-inch browns. And so we're seeing a huge decimation of our wild trout fisheries because of the lack of stocking. And I'm not a big advocate of stocked fish, but this certainly is having an effect. So if you could look into that or think about that, I'd appreciate it very much. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brad McFall, followed by Earl and Doug Brown.
My name is Brad McFall. I'm here from Mammoth Lakes. I'm a guide at the shop, trout fitter and trout fly. I just want to follow up with what Kevin said. You know, I've been fishing that water for 6 years, and I've definitely seen an improvement in the last 2 years. We're on it every day, and it's getting better. But one of the things that I wanted to come here and talk about was the East Walker River, right here outside of Bridgeport. I don't know if you guys are familiar with what's been going on there, but we've had really low flows, and I understand that there's certain water rights that some of the Nevada ranchers own. But those low flows create really high water temperatures, which is killing some of the fish. A couple of years back, we had a pretty serious fish kill in that river. It's a pretty renowned river. A lot of people know about it. A lot of people come here to fish it. I just wanted to bring it to your attention, if it was possible, that we could get any studies done, any way that we can improve that fishery. There's plenty of volunteers in the area that would do anything to help out. Just wanted to bring that to your attention. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown.
Earl Brown, Bishop, as you probably realize that my family and I own the campground. The main purposes, the causes of the fishing not being as good, the picture that Curtis showed, it was an older picture of the people standing along the edges. They don't do this anymore, and they don't do this when there isn't even any regulation that they don't have the opening day. What the biggest causes of are is Mono Lake, when they started draining the water out, putting the water into Mono Lake and not draining it and using it in the city. The temperature that Curtis talked about, raised and so forth, and the fishing just really went downhill from that time on. It's bound to level out, smooth out. And it's still, the temperature of the water is, algae is real bad, and it's, later on in the season, it's pretty tough fishing. We just want to see the thing open. You talk about the people, the numbers of people. You could relate to the amount of money that's in the cash register. The gross business of the campground is down over 30% from the first day that they changed the season, and it stays there. I mean, and that's people. The people that come in, they're fishing, are the ones that are putting the money in there. So there's 30% less people than there were. You're not taking it, like Curtis showed you. You're not taking that many fish if you take them all. I mean, I can take you back to when I caught 300 fish in a month, myself personally, a trout, and it was legal. The times have changed. It just is realistic to leave it open. I mean, it should be open. It should be open for regular fishing season. Thank you.
Thank you.
Doug Brown.
Hello, Commissioners. I'm Doug Brown. I'm here representing the bait fishing public of California. The bait fishermen in California have been losing water to fish in for the last 15 years. There's more restrictions added every year, and the special interest groups are discriminating against bait fishermen. And there's a lot of little kids, old people that recreate on the Upper Owens River that aren't able to fish there anymore. Sure, you can say, oh, well, they ought to go out. We'll teach them how to fly fish. That's fine. I've got four boys, and every one of them knows how to fly fish. They've all fished since they were little kids. But when they're little, they start out fishing with a worm. You fish with a worm, and then you, as you progress as a fisherman, you evolve, you change, just like anything. You start out fishing with bait, and 90% of you get to where you don't even want to catch a fish. All you want to do is go out and watch everybody else fish. I'd like to have the regulations changed back to the previous deal where the Upper Owens River, that 3-mile section, is open to regular regulations, the 5-fish limit. And as far as anything to do with Curtis Milliron, we know Curtis Milliron, okay? We live in a little town, Bishop. There's 5,000 people live there. But as far as any affiliation, no, there is none. He's an acquaintance, okay? And I think that you as commissioners, you need to stand behind the people that work for your office. And if your man that you hired says that there's not a problem, then you ought to stand behind him. I mean, otherwise, get rid of him. Don't keep a guy on the payroll. Fire him. You guys can just, you don't need any. Go hire these trout guys out here. They you can get them on a contract and be a lot cheaper than hiring Curtis. Thank you.
That concludes the cards I have on this item. I think Commissioner Flores had
questions.
Yeah. Commissioner Flores. You talked about the displacement. You mentioned the hours. Can you talk about your studies that looked at where those fishermen might have gone? Where the fishermen might have gone?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think they just stopped fishing and stayed at home, or do you think maybe they went to some of the other areas at home?
Oh, I'm sure that people get displaced, meaning they go to the other many opportunities in the Inyo and Mono counties to fish. But I was speaking to also just the tradition of fishing, and the people, anglers tend to go back to the place they know. You know, how many anglers go to Crowley every opening weekend? I meet people every year. This is my 30th opener at Crowley. If Crowley wasn't closed or was closed on the opener, would they go to Convict Lake? Well, they might not go at all. And that was the only point. There's no data.
Do you have any pictures of opening day currently?
Where? Oh, I'm sorry, what?
Have you gone out and assessed the percent of the fishing population on opening day? Still have an opening day.
The opening day on the Upper Owens River?
Yeah.
Yeah, this year, I went up to the, well, first off, the picture that we took was right from the bridge down, so that there's nobody there, of course, because
right,
that's closed.
I'm talking about when it opened. Go out and assess the fishing population at their opening?
No, not when it opened.
So in essence, there's two openers, correct?
There is an opener, yes.
There's an opener for that section
of the river, right.
And then there's the second, the general fishing opening.
Last Saturday April would be the general fishing opener, and then the Friday preceding Memorial Weekend would be the opener for that 3-mile section. I did not go out on that day to see how many people showed up and we're fishing that river.
So people still have the opportunity to fish the Godlike, like it's just delayed by a couple of weeks?
It's delayed by almost a month, and then it's the last month and a half. So the beginning of the season and the end of the season. Right. Certainly there's the 4 months in between the middle of the season, which is still available for anglers.
Yeah. My point, you came sort of with the picture for these 11,000, or now you're saying
11,000 hours of effort.
Right. And my point is that these people are not being displaced. They're not fishing. Maybe some choose not to because that's their favorite fishing grounds. But, you know, I used to hit Manzanita Lake open there all the time. I don't do that. I went to found other places. Fishing wasn't, you know, the best. So these people can actually go and fish. They're not prohibited from fishing.
Oh, absolutely not.
They're fishing that spot.
They certainly can go other places, and they can go the Friday preceding Memorial Weekend, they can fish for the next 4 months.
Right. Did you take a look to see what the benefits are? What have we learned from this? I mean, you tended to take a look at the older data. I mean, take a look at the new data. That's what I was really looking for. What have been the positives? I mean, we've heard some anecdotal stuff from some of the guys. They're now fishing waters that they didn't fish anymore. Or they fish very little. And now it seems the fish have come back because of this, the fact that we delayed over so we think the fish have been upstream and spawned. So Have you taken a look at that? That's what I wanted to see. What have been the positive benefits?
We did not initiate a new large-scale study to replicate the kind of data that we had in the past. That was a pretty expensive and intensive study. And so to do that this year was just not in our budget and our capabilities.
Right. Well, I would encourage you to go out and take a look and study that and see
Sam just reminded me that for the 5 years he's been on this commission, this keeps coming up.
Yeah.
So
this was
an issue prepared.
The first commission meeting in October. 5 years. Yeah. Sure.
But there's no motion to change the regulation back.
Okay.
Which was handed out to you this morning. And Mr. John Guth is present to provide comments and his recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is John Guth.
Wardens, could you ask the people to move outside? They don't want to have another meeting.
My name's John Guth. I'm president of the California Lobster and Trap Fishermen's Association. And I've been fishing lobster here for over 40 years in the state of California. And we're asking the commission to amend Title 14, Section 122 of Title 14 to allow for transferability of lobster permits. We feel that we need access to our fishery now. We've had a moratorium in place for, I think it's since 2002, Morro Bay meeting, on the lottery that we had originally when we went to limited entry in 1984. And the commission at that time asked the department to meet with us and implement a transferable permit by the season 2004-2005. And I think some of you were there. And that hasn't taken place. So and that's why I'm here today to kind of get this thing going again and see what we can do. Now, we have an old fleet. Basically, we have a lot of fishermen that are 45 to 65 years old in our fleet, 66, 67. And so we think we need to get an influx of young blood here, and there are people that would like to get in. And I think it's in the benefit of the fishery and the resource to have access to our fishery. The processors would like to see it. The public has a right to it, I believe, so that we can go forward. As an association, we've always been proactive and tried to stay on top of our fishery. And our fishery is a healthy fishery. We don't have a problem with the resource. We have a sustainable catch of 500,000 to 600,000 pounds a year. With spikes in the El Nino year, we have spikes and increases in production, but overall, we have a healthy fishery, and we think that it's time to go forward with this to keep it that way. And we started with the limited entry that we got right here in Bridgeport in 1994, I believe it was, that the commission voted to go ahead and close our fishery and go to limited entry. And we had at the time 365 permits in the fishery, which takes place from basically from point conception to the Mexican border.
And we have now, we have 225 permits left, as we had a lottery in place that every time 10 dropped out, one was admitted, was in a lottery, by the use of a lottery. So we, the number was down to 225 when we put a moratorium on the lottery. Looking at the commission's guidelines for restricted access fisheries and looking at the Marine Life Management Act, we thought it's a time that we needed to go ahead and look for restricted access and transferability. So we would like to go ahead with that at this time. And we have 160 boats that actually participate out of the 225 permits that are issued. There's really only 165 participating boats, give or take a couple each year. So, and out of that, so that leaves us 65 virtually latent permits, people looking to capitalize on a future transferable permit. And these permit holders are not fishing and they're not really vested in the fishery. And so we've come up with a plan to go to transferable permits for 120 boats. The remainder of the 40 boats that are active to get to the 160 would be non-transferable. They would be able to continue to fish. We wouldn't eliminate any of the 225 boats, but we feel that the number would immediately come down to somewhere in the 160 area if we took away the carrot of the transferable permit for the speculators that are still out there holding them. I think you can follow that. So that's what we've done. We were promised to, not promised, but we were looking at this 2004-2005 season for transferability. We know that's not going to happen. The department hasn't really had the time or the money, whatever the reason, hasn't taken place. So we, on our own, went ahead and hired Mr. John Duffy to help assist us in achieving transferability. And I think John has the background because to do the regulatory language, to look at the fishery. His background when he was with the department for 30 years was with lobster. He has the expertise, so we thought that he would be a person who would be able to accomplish our goals. And so that's basically where we are. We had met with the department. We got data from the department about the 160 active boats and so forth, and we came up with, through that data, with three meetings up and down the coast with not just our members, but with all the lobster fishermen we could get. And we had, of the active boats, we had a 90% consensus for this proposal that we laid out in front of you. And our proposal is fairly simple. We don't think it's convoluted in any way. We think it's fair. And it basically, in going back, our seasons are take place in both years. We start in October, we end up in March. So we went back to the 1996, 1997 to start, and we ended with 2000, 2001, that five-year period. We were asking for 500 pounds landings in four out of those 5 years, which isn't a lot of landings, not a lot to ask to qualify for transferable permit. Or going from the 97, 98 year, we were requiring a 2,000 pound limit for the back, going back 4 years from that 2001, so that a new entry from the lottery that had participated would still be able to get in. So that's where we came up with, and the rest of the permits would be non-transferable. That would get us down to 120 boats. The department was concerned with the capacity goal, but I think as fishermen that have been in the business for a long time, that we looked at the criteria, we looked at the Marine Life Management Act, and we looked at the restricted access policy, and we think we have a ballpark number there that we can work with. We didn't want to let the whole 160 boats in because there are a lot of those, the 40 boats from 120 to 160, a lot of those are not very active. They have minimal landings.
and we didn't think that if we let them become transferable, we would be overcapitalizing the fishery. So that's how we arrived at it, and we had a pretty good consensus, and we met with a lot of people, most of the active lobster guys. And then as a part two, we thought that it would be good to put that transferable permit in place and then go back and see how many boats actually shook out of that fishery after a year or two, and then go back and form a committee or of some type or meet with the department and address department's concerns on trap limits and other capacity goal issues. And the trap limits are very controversial amongst us. Different sized boats, different people fish from 800 and some people fish 200. So we don't have a consensus on that. And we thought we could sit down with the department, and if the need is there for trap limits, and resource-wise, I don't know that we have to do that, but we are more than willing to go ahead and implement trap limits also. But I think we need to wait and see what kind of permits we're looking at in the future. So that's basically what our plan is, and I don't know what action, if any, you can take today. Or
do we have speaker cards on this?
We have one in addition.
We'll listen to the rest of the comments.
Okay. And then we'll thank you.
We may take
some
action.
And congratulations on your awards. And
thank you.
Especially Mr. Trainer, who has been very helpful to us through the years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Guth. Mr. Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I'd like to remind the commissioners that in the abalone fishery was the first limited entry fishery in California. And that when the permits became transferable in the abalone fishery, we saw an undue, effort on the resource. Someone that invests a lot of money, to get into the abalone fishery, you had to buy two permits, like around $20,000. Then a boat, around $30,000. So someone is investing $40,000 to $60,000 to get into the abalone fishery. This fishery here, market value of these permits is yet to be unknown, but the investment will be quite substantial. Someone that invests into a fishery like that has got to get out and is going to fish hard. They are going to be undue on the resource. The resource will be unduly targeted because of the large investment of money in a transferable permit. I'd like to remind you again about the abalone fishery. In the abalone fishery, unlike any other fishery in California, you had to pass a written exam before you even allowed into the fishery until transferability came. As soon as transferability came, that written test was thrown out the door. Now, up until that time, many people never even were allowed into the lottery because they weren't able to pass a written test or identifying the species that they were targeting. I would think that a written test would be something that all the fisheries in California would like to observe, but we do not. Again, in the abalone fishery, when transferability came, we saw the resource take a heavy hit because of the investment that the people make to buy into the fishery. Thank you. And in the abalone fishery, it was only a couple of years after transferability, they closed the fishery altogether. So those people that invested $50,000, $60,000 in the fishery were left high and dry, and the commissioners saw fit not to compensate them in any way. I have one other question, Mr. President. Where is our commissioner? He seems to be lacking into the director of the Fish and Game Commission. It looks like a rebound of the last commissioner. Didn't want to show up at the meetings because people would be able to ask him questions.
Oh, he's here, and he's working right outside the door.
Is that right?
He's been here for a couple, 2 or 3 hours.
If it makes you feel better.
We did anticipate added effort, and one of the things we've talked to the department about was when these permits became transferable, that would be the place, that might be the place to put the trap limit on the transferred permit immediately at that time. So that was something we already discussed, the extra effort.
Thanks. Are there any questions or comments from the commission on this? I would like to make a motion.
I'd like to ask the department.
Yeah. What's the department?
Where are things at?
There you go.
Yeah, actually, the department's been working on and off with the lobster industry on this. The proposal's a very good proposal. Hopefully with the spot prawn fishery issues coming to a close, that will free up some staff that can really engage in this. If the commission asks us to proceed, we would work with the industry, of course, and make sure we don't have problems with capacity and overcapitalization issues. But I think there's a good foundation here to really make this happen. And timing-wise, if the commission asks us to move on this, we would ask that we have a discussion hearing in April with an adoption in May of 2005, because any earlier than that, the fishermen are going to be fishing, and they won't really have a chance to fully engage in any discussion. So that if you do want to do this, we'd ask that it be a little later than sooner. But in either case, it would still be in place for the lobster season that year. I don't know if you have any more specific questions, but I think we're there.
When are lobster permits required to be purchased?
This fishery is restricted access already?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think the plan sounds well thought out, too. Yeah. We should.
I'd like
well,
that.
A motion, Mr. President.
I've got a motion.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like that.
But you want to say something?
No, I'm waiting for your motion.
Okay. I'd like to make a motion that the commission authorize our staff to publish notice of its intent to consider making the lobster permit transferable, and would like to also recommend that the department have Marcy work with the lobster industry and their consultant on the proposed regulations.
Awesome.
Okay, I got a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
What's your...
Aye.
I was just going to ask, did you ask the department to work, and not necessarily staff?
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Do you want the job? Staff. Department staff.
I had a quick question. So if I understand your motion correctly, does the timing I suggested work for you in the industry?
Yeah.
You can work with that. That'll give us a little more time and get them in place.
The department will work together with them and the consultant.
Yeah.
I think we can get them. Make
okay.
it happen.
All right. Thank you, commissioners.
Good job. You guys did a good job. You're consulting.
We're going to take item 8 out of order, and then after we finish item 8, we are going to break for lunch. That way there's some individuals that would like to hit the road. Item 8 is on the agenda to confirm the Commission's June 25, 2004 action to issue 11 non-transferable Tier 3 spot prawn trap vessel permits. I won't go into a lot of detail. The Commission knows that this has been an ongoing issue for a couple of years, and you made a decision regarding the conversion of trawl spot prawn trawl permits to trap permits, and that they would be non-transferable. The notice that we had published, the department's recommendation was that the Tier 3 permits would become transferable, similar to the Tier 1, after 3 years. The commission decided to have them non-transferable. Your staff had to go out to a 15-day notice because of that change. We received public comments, copies of which are in Exhibit 8. I believe we had two trawl fishermen that recommended that they become transferable, similar as the department had recommended. We also had three letters from trap fishermen recommending non-transferable permits. And we have some individuals that would like to provide comments at this time. Tom Raftigan, followed by Bob Osborne. If you're just supporting the commission's action of June 25th, we would appreciate knowing that, or if you're opposed to it.
Not having testified this morning, yes, essentially we're in support of the commission, but I would like to first off congratulate the commission on their award as the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Association as Commission of the Year. You folks, I don't know why any of you take this job in the first place. It's a thankless job, and you do a great job, and it's nice that you're being recognized for it. So, Mr. President, members of the commission, nice work. And
do you think it was the Channel Islands that put us over the top there?
Next on the agenda, I'm sure that that was one of the things that, that got it up there. Maybe it was your attorneys that got it kept in place. I don't know. But in any event, you do an awful lot of work. You invest a tremendous amount of time, and it really is a thankless job. And thanks very much for doing it. We agree with you a lot of the time, and when we disagree, we've always got a level playing field up here, and we greatly support that. Thank you. And one more thing, to the executive director, to Bob Traynor, hats off for a great job. You know, these awards don't come easily. They don't come alone, so nice work there. We just quickly wanted to say on item number 8 that, you know, we do support the commission's action. We really are supportive of getting much more sustainable, selective fishing gear out there, and thanks for moving in that direction.
Thank you for your kind words.
Hi. Boy, it's really nice to see a full panel here, great all the way up here in the mountains. My name is Bob Osborne, United Anglers of Southern California. Just wanted to come in here and thank you for coming in and giving an opportunity to the spot prawn trawlers to move over into a sustainable fishery. I trust the commission's judgment on the issues of what your capacity goals are and so forth. But I think it's important to move ahead and make sure that these guys have an opportunity to fish. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Guth or Wood, anybody else want to comment?
John Guth, I just support your decision. I know it was a hard one. I support it.
Thank you. Mr. President, I think a motion would be in order.
Okay, we're going to take a lunch break right now, and we'll be back here at 1:30. Back into the agenda, I want to recognize a couple of folks. didn't recognize this morning. We have the director of the Department of Fish and Game with us, Ryan Broderick, and who was here earlier, as I said, and working outside. We have with us Mike Valentine, the general counsel for the department, and we have with us Don Cook, the Northern California. Don, I've seen him here once.
He's back there.
Okay, I think I got everybody. We can move on. Agenda, Director.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President. We'll move back to item number six on the Commission's agenda. It's consideration of 2004-2005 California Duck Stamp and Ducks Unlimited Marsh projects. The Department is prepared to provide its recommendations for the proposed projects for the upcoming year. I believe Deputy Director Mastrup will be providing that information to the Commission.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I think the Commission's been provided with a list of the projects. It's a suite of habitat enhancement projects, both in Californians and some obliged Canadian projects. I don't have anything specific to add to that list other than if there's questions about any projects on the list. I don't know what the duck stamp is. You mean the artwork? We can find out for you.
Questions?
It was brief.
Motion would be in order to
second. Okay, the move is seconded on a question. Any all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The ayes have it, and it'll be over.
The next item is item seven, and it's the department's report and recommendations on its review of commission policies. And I believe Deputy Director Mastrup will be also making this report.
Again, good afternoon, Commissioners. As our ongoing series of installments, the department looked at three additional policies for review. Those three were commercial fishing and packing industries policy, policy on emerging fisheries, and on kelp. The first one, commercial fishing and packing industries, it's the policy that basically encourages development of fisheries in the packing industry, both here and abroad. As you're well aware, that the ocean resources are under stress and there's limited opportunity to actually do this. And this is one policy the department thinks the commission may want to look at in terms of emphasis and in terms of all the other things going on. The emerging fisheries policy, we think it's a good policy and we have no recommendations to change it. And the kelp policy is one that sets aside a certain percentage for kelp harvesting or beds not to be harvested. And that's one that we will also want to look at in a little more detail, whether it still applies, especially given the MLPA issues and the fisheries issues. But we don't have anything specific at this point. Are there any questions about any three of those? I'm not sure how familiar you are. I can read you any of the policies if you'd like. On another note, I noticed in the agenda briefing that the commission may not be entirely pleased with the way we've been delivering these policy updates, and you know, we are certainly willing to look at doing it other ways. I don't know if the commission would like to discuss that at this point or not. I mean, is the commission satisfied with our kind of doing them in little installments, or do you want to go back to the old way, which we do, I think it was in May, we give you a massive report on all the policies at once with recommendations. It's your prerogative.
I like installments. Otherwise, it becomes overwhelming. But then again, also we like to get a lay of the land, too.
I think that's it. Did you want to say something?
Mr. President, members of the Commission, I think in terms of the installments, we're happy to provide them in that, but I just offer that I will engage in this discussion of the policy, and I'd like it maybe at the kickoff meeting or at one point to at least have a quick overview document on policies that gives us a context. I wouldn't want to drop them all at the same meeting, but I think it would be important to know the scope and the context of the policies we currently have just on a topical basis, if not in detail, and offer my support and engagement with the Commission in reviewing the policies and appreciation to the staff and Sankey for what they have done at this point.
Yeah, I think we just, no action, we just stay with that.
All right, thank you. And that's what we'll do. We'll try to do an annual brief overview of what you're facing, and then maybe would it be helpful as like a schedule for the year, and we'll bring it to you in bite-sized pieces.
With that, we'll move to item 9, and I believe that's the issue that most individuals are here for this afternoon. It's broken up into three parts, and the first part is Department's progress report regarding development of state-federal cooperative agreements with NOAA fisheries under Section 6 of the Federal Endangered Species Act. Regarding coho salmon, as the Commission may recall, at your last meeting in Crescent City, the Commission tabled its consideration of listing coho salmon as threatened and endangered to allow the department, i.e. the director, to enter into negotiations with NOAA fisheries regarding possible state-federal cooperative agreements under Section 6 of the Federal Act. And this first item is to receive that report from the director. I believe Director Broderick is prepared at this time to make his report.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the Commission.
I hope that's not a portent of things to come, but it is on and it's in my hand instead of in the stand. Thank you, Mr. President, members of the Commission. Pursuant to your direction at Crescent City, we developed a letter transmittal for a draft conservation agreement. I delivered that to Dr. Hogarth in Washington last week on Thursday. The presentation and the discussion was to engage Section 6, the Federal Endangered Species Act, to provide essentially a review of the attributes and request a review of the conservation programs that we've undertaken. The form in Section 6 ESA provides a mechanism for federal-state cooperation in the management of the listed species. The vehicle for this is a cooperative agreement. We drafted provided a draft of a cooperative agreement, which was presented. It also provides in the cooperative agreement in Section 6 opportunities for as much as 75% funding of the prescribed recovery actions. Fundamental, as we discussed at Crescent City, to this recovery plan and the cooperative agreement is a coho recovery strategy that the Commission adopted in February. The discussions and how to implement and reconcile and improve implementation of both the Federal and State Endangered Species Act, without a question, was a common objective in my meetings with both Dr. Hogarth and with Rod McGinnis, who is here attending on behalf of NOAA as the Regional Administrator for the Southwest Region. The agreement and the availability of funding, as everything else in life, is contingent upon the existence of continued implementation of an adequate and active program conducted by the state and consistent with the ESA for the conservation of coho. Once again, I think our recovery plan provides that template.
It's an additional tool. It's not a tool that goes beyond and above the balance of the laws in the state, whether they be through the Fish and Game Commission, Board of Forestry, water rights, water quality issues, but it's a major component that can hopefully meld all those together. It is not a replacement for existing state statutes, nor are CESA obligations. We believe that in the initial discussions and what we've presented, and I'll provide copies of the actual letter that went to Secretary Don Evans, the Commerce, and to Rod McGinnis at NOAA, and was hand-delivered to Assistant Administrator Dr. Bill Hogarth, that we have an opportunity to pull these two federal joint state listings and the species through our recovery plan together in a comprehensive program. It's going to require engagement both on the scientific and in the financing level. It'll require engagement in us in determining and assessing abilities to both influence federal appropriations and, as importantly, match federal appropriations with state funds. At this point, I think it's appropriate to let the folks that administer this on a routine basis, and there's nothing such as routine necessarily, but certainly have the day-to-day review of conservation agreements. And I'd like to introduce Rod R. McGinnis. He's the regional administrator for NOAA for the Southwest region. He was kind enough to cut his short trip, his trip short from Washington drive down from Reno, which was his closest destination point this morning. So thank you. Rod?
Thank you, Mr. President, commissioners, and thank you, Ryan. Director Roderick has said, he's already taken steps to initiate discussion of Section 6 under the federal ESA. He approached both myself and my boss and the head of National Marine Fisheries Service, Bill Hogarth, in informal discussions, and has recently submitted the formal letter to the Secretary of Commerce, and that letter transmitted a draft proposed cooperative agreement between the state of, between the department and NOAA Fisheries. We are currently looking at that agreement. It's a good starting point. Section 6 of the Federal Endangered Species Act encourages cooperation between the federal authorities, Secretary of Commerce and the Secretary of Interior, and states that have a current ongoing protection for species that are listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. It's not a substitute for the state action, but it's an addition to the state action. The biggest benefits that I can see out of a Section 6 include the potential avenue for federal funding for some of these activities. The federal funding is authorized under Section 6 if we have an agreement. It would then need to be appropriated annually. And currently, I think the first time that NOAA Fisheries got an appropriation for a Section 6 agreement was this year, and it was money that went to East Coast states, and it totaled $900,000, but that's a step in the right direction. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Interior have had larger appropriations for Section 6 agreements. And we're hoping to have more come our way in the future when we have the plan to implement. Section 6 also would provide us with a framework for sitting down and working on making the state recovery plan for coho, incorporating those measures into our federal recovery plan, which has to come in a different, obviously, if we're different, it's got to come in a different package. It has a slightly different slant on on the contents of a recovery plan, but there's a lot of good work and cooperation that went into developing the state plan, and that's not something that we're going to ignore. It's something that we intend to build on in the federal recovery plan, and somewhere along the line, we should have one plan that will guide COA recovery in the entire state of California. Both federal and state cooperation involved there. I'm available to answer any questions. I, again, look forward to continue working with the department on further development of this Section 6 agreement. Thank you.
Any comments or questions from the commission? Thank you. Thank you for coming. Director Roderick, do you want to say anything else? I might point out, too, that in the handout material that we provided the commissioners, we do have a copy of a memo from the director to the commission providing additional comments on coho salmon-related information that had been received by the commission and the department after August of 2002, so we have that information available.
Just, I think there was a sincere interest in back to life, a sincere interest in and recognition that we have to have programs at the federal and state level that complement each other. It provides the opportunity both for the agencies to work together, but more importantly, and as importantly, to provide a uniform understanding from both the environmental community and the regulated community that there is a process that is harmonized. And that's the value and the critical, I think, challenge is to implement the recovery plan that we have in front of us.
I appreciate the effort you made since the last meeting.
Do we have any idea how much this is going to cost us? I've heard lots of figures.
The recovery plan had numbers. I could have Larry Wheat come up and review it in detail if you want it more accurately than I can characterize it. But the recovery plan, as I reviewed it, talked about is a variety of programs, not just cost through the Department of Fish and Game, but a recovery plan taking 25 to 30 years and approximately $5 billion. Larry, is that close to the summary side? Larry says yes.
How much do you expect to get from the beds?
How many billion do you want? How much do we expect? You know, the reality is you raise a question. I think Mr. McGinnis raised it, that NOAA has not had a history of getting a lot of Section 6 monies. I can go back to the terrestrial side through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they've had fairly substantial funding through Section 6. For both the planning and implementation of conservation strategies, such as habitat conservation plans. Having a recovery plan as a foundation, I think, should be a powerful tool that we're going to have to go out and seek federal appropriation and the state match to generate that kind of income. The federal and the state budgets are no surprise to anybody. They're realities that you deal with on a day-to-day basis. We're going to have to push long term, but this is a 25 to 30 year window. If we can beat that clock, that's great. We've had substantial investment, as I reviewed at the Crescent City meeting already. We still have proposition and bond monies. We've made coho a focus for recovery, both on the landscape through the Wildlife Conservation Board, through the Coastal Conservancy. There's discussions, you know. Is money, all the money there for all the species we need? No. So this will be a challenge, but I think we've got a great foundation in the recovery plan.
Are you concerned that maybe, in essence, what we might have here is a plan and not the money implemented, and at the same time, perhaps those folks that are on the ground, you know, trying to recover the species, the farmers, right?
it's certainly a concern and a challenge to make the laws that we have work both on the land and for the fisheries and for the recovery plan. I think we'll see in the recovery plan that folks have been using that as a template and have been actively. These recovery plan objectives didn't come out of a fictitious circumstance. These stressors and the folks have been working to reduce those stressors have been reducing those stressors for some time, and they've considerable investment as we discussed since 2000. My obligation is to do everything I can to encourage the continued investment, both from individual landowners and participation of restoration groups. That's going to require our continued leadership and financing where we can provide it, and it's going to require a continuation of trying to maintain relationships to the good and the bad times when it comes to financing and conditions of the species.
Item 9B is for the Commission's consideration of closing the public comment period on the proposed changes to Section 670.5 of Title 14 of the California Code of Regulations regarding adding coho salmon to the list of threatened and endangered species.
Move to close the public comment.
Second. Move and second.
We haven't been very deeply involved with salmon, but one of the things that struck me as I was reading Ray Cannon's book, Fishing the Pacific Coast, the book was first published in 1950, and in the book, Ray Cannon goes back and goes over a lot of the different fishes of the Pacific, including salmon, and he talked about fish plants, about stocking salmon prior to 1950. We've got $5 billion on the line trying to reestablish a fishery that's based on not bringing back, not augmenting it with stockfish, but bringing back original strains. And I'm wondering where those original strains were first measured. If you're stocking fish before 1950, there's a very good possibility that the strains are already planted fish out there. Is there a listing of the fish that have been planted by the Department of Fish and Game and the feds that we can go back and kind of examine this? And I would think before somebody spends $5 billion, we ought to figure out the direction we're going first. Thanks.
Thank you. So now I will move to having heard from Tom to close a public comment on this item.
And I'll second it.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
Ayes have it.
Okay. Item C is consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 670.5 of Title 14 California Code of Regulations to add coho salmon to the list of endangered species from San Francisco to Punta Gorda, and then from Punta Gorda to
listing as endangered and threatened in the relevant parts of its range. Since we started down this path, we have received a great deal of testimony and evidence regarding the various good works that are going on all over the state, much of which are actually funded by state government, some of which are not, to try to help this Selmont and others recover.
I have no reason to doubt that those things are taking place, particularly since my agency is the number one that is funding some of these efforts. But I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that there are more fish now than there were 2 years ago. And that is the critical issue that I think the Commission has to consider. Director Broderick gave us a pretty well thought out and well written, with some nice graphics, which always warms my heart, account of what the department considers the issues to be, and the various evidence and testimony that was brought to us in the last year or so. Since we started considering this issue, I continue to think that this is a fish that is hanging on the edge. I think that however much we have done for other salmon species, it has not been enough for coho. And I think that listing is warranted and in fact is necessary. I hope that the Section 6 process goes well. I hope that we get federal dollars. I'll certainly be working hard to lobby Congress for money. In the meantime, I think it's important that the state take this action. I'm ready to make a motion to that effect, or I can make
Well, I would like to add my voice to Sam's and to all the folks who have been here over the last year and a half on this issue. I too think the science is bottom line on this, and that it's the information we have out of the dozens and dozens of studies over the years that we've studied show that this species is definitely warrants threatened and endangered status. I made the original motion. I've listened to lots of testimony by good folks doing good restoration projects. I hope they continue to do it. Jobs. I think that the timber industry has made a very strong attempt at arguing that somehow
the listing is going to impact carpenters and machinists throughout the Northern California. Unfortunately, I mean that, the timber industry has already taken major hits based on all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with this listing, because this listing hasn't happened and the jobs are already gone. I mean, that's obvious. So I just think that given, and quite frankly, the law doesn't even allow us to consider that, but even if you wanted to, it wouldn't be the fault of listing the salmon that nice people who appeared before us are in economic hard times. I think that the species just has the scientific data, has a recovery plan that can actually recover it. I've seen recovery plans work for other species. Obviously, it's the recovery plan, not just the listing that matters, but the listing triggers all the other things. So I just think it's important to have this year and a half of stakeholders meeting and people making political deals and things going on in front of the microphone in back rooms, that we actually list this today and vote the way that the science has instructed us and the law has instructed us to vote. And I'm willing to do that also.
Section 6 is something that we have to do for good governance. It's something that we need to do with the Endangered Species Act on far more issues than cover. But does it preclude the science that we have and the answer market recommendation we provided to you in Crescent City? No, I do not believe it does. We'll have to work to implement this law, but we need to get on with implementation. My recommendation is, as it was in Crescent City, listing revenue from the department is to proceed with the as warranted finding and put it on, go through the EPA process, initiate the Administrative Procedures Act process to have it added to the list.
Hats off to all of them. It's time to give ourselves the credit that we need.
that other people are getting the same or the best commission in the country. That's be that way with the regulation.
So, with that in mind, I move that we amend Section 670.5, Title 14 of the California Code of Regulation, excuse me, to list coho salmon between San Francisco and Punta Gorda as an endangered species, and coho salmon between Punta Gorda and the northern border of California as a threatened species.
I'll second that motion.
And I will call for our roll call. Vote.
Commissioner Schuchat?
Aye.
Commissioner Hattori?
Aye.
Commissioner Flores? Commissioner Flores? Is that a mean it's an abstention?
Yep.
Okay. Commissioner Hendrickson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kellogg?
Aye.
Motion passes on a 4-aye vote and 1 abstention.
Mr. President? If I might, at this point in time, as a point of procedural clarification, may I suggest that it might be appropriate for the Commission to adopt perhaps something called a supplemental finding to address the additional information the Commission has received from a variety of parties since the original finding was made 2 years ago regarding the coho salmon. The Department has put together a rather lengthy analysis of most of these materials, and it would be, I think, appropriate for the Commission to at least state its conclusion as to those additional materials at this point in time, or if you wish, ask your staff to help assemble something to be considered at your late August meeting. But I do think that since those materials have been presented in this most unusual and lengthy process, that it would be useful for the Commission to be able to adopt some kind of procedural finding as to those supplemental materials as well.
Did at the last hearing the Department say that they acknowledged receipt and analysis of these materials and that they had no significant effect or impact on the original recommendation and finding? I mean, I'm forgetting. But I mean, why do we have to recommend to adopt something that doesn't impact the decision we just made?
Oh, no, Mr. Toy, my thought only was is that to the extent that material has been provided to the Commission as an additional input to the Commission and its consideration, that to the extent the Commission has chosen to evaluate it and address it, that perhaps we should at least say formally some form of conclusory statement as to what we think of it as well. The Department assembled a rather lengthy assessment of it, but it may be appropriate for the Commission to, if it wishes, adopt that assessment as its own to conclude this matter, conclude that the additional materials presented over the last 2 years have not changed the Commission's underlying interpretation of its initial finding regarding the danger or threat status.
So moved.
Yeah.
Unless you have flowery language for us.
I'd be perfectly willing to say, if you wish, that I think the Department did an extraordinary job of analysis, and if you wish to incorporate that as your finding, you can make that finding at this point in time if you wish.
So you're talking about the memo from the Director Broderick, the August 4th memo?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah.
So we'll have to make that.
Well, do we need to do this as a separate item, or can we?
We can do it right now if you wish, sir.
Okay. Then I'll move that we commend the Director for his masterful memo of analysis, and we adopt it as our own and think that it speaks for us and it's what we think.
I think that we've already actually done that, but
yeah.
Well, except the second
that
vote.
Thank you.
Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Ayes have it.
Okay.
Next item.
Our next item is receipt of the Department's legislative report.
Thank you.
The commission.
Maybe you want to take a short recess. Okay, that was easy. Receipt of department informational items, department budget. We finally got a budget.
It didn't take you long to pass that.
We have a budget. We have a state budget. We have a departmental budget. The good news is that it's passed. The realities are we have plenty of challenges, and we also have some opportunities for some initiatives that folks may discuss tomorrow. But I guess I'll caution my employees
and the general public as well, is that the Thailand oil monies, they're in a bucket proposal, and we shouldn't spend the money until we know we have the income from that particular account. But there was some proposed additions to the governor's budget through that mechanism. I haven't got this confirmed in writing from the Department of Finance, so I will suggest that we'll report back to you at the next commission in terms of whether they're fulfilled. But there were five separate items ranging from fish hatcheries to coho recovery or steelhead salmon account Marine Life Protection Act and issues that were in the queue for funding if revenues are adequate, which will be a review, I think, if I'm not mistaken, April, May of next year. The budget continues to be, it's not an increase from last year, certainly, but the department took, in my view, over the last 3 years, some pretty significant reductions at a time when costs have not gone down, they've gone up, whether it be we're not in a growth mode, but we're going to make the absolute best what we've got, and having a signed budget is the first step in implementing whatever changes we need to make to stay within our budget and do good work. There are a variety of recommendations or proposals that are certainly out for public review. Those proposals cut across all state government. The focus was to look at a variety of accumulated programs and organizations. The California Performance Review did that. They have some proposals as it relates to our law enforcement. There's, if you're specific to the department, and I want to put these in context, there's much larger global changes that are proposed. Specific to the department, we would have our law enforcement moved into a separate division of public safety and homeland defense. That's a proposal. We would have changes in what the Wildlife Conservation Board does, which isn't part of the agent for the department almost exclusively at this point. That would change. A variety of commissions and conservancies would no longer exist. This commission is not one of the ones that was identified for elimination. So it's across the board, and I think as we go through this, there's going to be a series of public hearings starting August 13th, I believe, through September. I think it would be appropriate to look at the variety of comments that come in from the public on the proposals and report in your October board meeting. This is a work in progress, obviously. There's a whole lot of opportunities and a whole lot of proposals that obviously significantly change how and what the department and or how they would deliver the programs and what component. So it's not fair to just give you the org chart review. I haven't read the several thousand pages in detail. I've just got through the first portion as it relates to the department.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Kellogg, Mr. President, I apologize. I should let you know that we are going through and anticipated and providing very specific review of the whole thing in the next, actually in a short period of time, and that information will be provided to the Secretary of Resources and up through the Cabinet Secretary. So we are providing an evaluation and analysis of how we think it would affect the department in a very honest and, we hope, constructive fashion.
Thank you, Director Broderick. Item 11B is update on the Abalone Recovery and Management Plan. Mr. Eric Larson of the Department's Marine Region.
Thank you, Mr. Trainer. I'm here today, Commissioners, to get some clarity. At our last meeting up in Crescent City, I gave as Commissioner Hattoy puts it, a mind-numbing presentation. And we left with some questions. We had some questions from Commissioner Flores and left with an understanding about a request that Commissioner Flores made. However, I wanted to get some clarity, and we weren't, since the Commission didn't make a motion, I wasn't clear on what action the Commission wanted us to take. I will repeat sort of what our understanding, what Commissioner Flores had requested, and then you can, Commissioner Flores, if there's any clarity you need, you can add that to it. What was asked was I gave a presentation on what our index sites were for monitoring the population in the North Coast and explained that we have four current index sites that are historic. Three of them are historic data collection sites. The fourth one, Salt Point, was added in recent years to give us additional data. And the concern was that those sites do not adequately represent the overall population on the North Coast and that those sites are heavily fished. Commissioner Flores then asked if we would add additional sites, and I made the statement that we would do that, that we would address that comment in our response to comments within the document. I wanted to point out that the document addresses that issue. That we recognize that we have a data-poor situation, that four sites are not adequate to address the overall population status, but that those are the sites that we currently have and that we've been utilizing for a period of time to collect data. We recognize those as our interim management sites, and our long-term goal would be to move from the regional-based management, the North Coast, the Central Coast, the South Coast, to area-based management. So divide those areas up into systems that function uniquely from each other, where we collect data individually from that. That's our long-term goal. It's not something that we're able to implement immediately, and thus our interim management plan are those four sites. So the answer is yes, we will add more sites as we move into the long-term management program. And my question for the Commission is, was it the intent of the Commission for us to move more quickly into developing more sites, thereby we'd need a motion from the Commission to do that, or as I've provided language here in the handouts I've given you, will you wait until we adopt the adaptive management plan and let us move forward with the implementation of our long-term plan as we're able to do so?
My feeling was, when we talked about this at the last meeting, was that we wanted more sites used because the four sites were the most popular sites of the entire area, and you weren't getting an honest read on us because it had such an impact and access because of the access from the public. So I don't know if that's...
Maybe I can help clarify some of that information. Is that those sites, as you see in the handout I provide you today, there's a map which shows the assessment sites, and one is a fishery independent survey, and one is the assessment site using creel surveys. Our fishery independent surveys cover both the nearshore environment, where recreational fishermen can access up to about 28 feet depth in water, as well as an assessment of some of the offshore resources, which we refer to as refugia. Those are an area that is off the outside of the ability of fishermen to catch. So we have a deep water assessment, and we have the nearshore, the recreational fishery site assessment as well. Yes, I agree with you that those sites represent fished locations, but we also get an assessment of what's happening offshore. Under an area management plan, which we would move to in our long-term goal, when we implement that, we would use more sites, and we've already begun to do that. We added one site this year, which is the former Sterneta Ranch site near Point Arena, to get an assessment prior to that site being opened up to fishing of what the resources are there. As we gain the ability through adjustment of staffing, we work with universities and other interested groups, we'll bring more sites online. But the management plan itself was written based on the information that we have at hand, recognizing it's data poor. We will bolster that and continue to move towards our long-term goal. But how we can do that and whether we can implement that depends on many factors. You know, it's a hard question to answer. We haven't even adopted the ARMP yet. We would move immediately to implement the interim management plan of the ARMP, which calls for quite a bit of work. And as we move forward, we would begin to move towards our long-term goals. I would estimate that we could get into a long-term management plan somewhere between 6 and 10 years. But, you know, if it's...
I can't wait that long. You know, Eric, quite often this is not new. Quite often, you know, we ask for things to get done, and we're always told that we can do it down the road, you know, on the long-term spectrum, if they're doable, but in the immediate future, they're not. And one is to figure out a way that we can get this done sooner rather than later. And I know that Ryan and Salty and their hands are tired. The money's not there. But it's frustrating for as a commissioner to sit here and always hear them get them off than not. So figure out a way to think out of the box, be creative, use those public resources, those folks out there that said they'd help you go out and assess those sites. So that's what I'd like to see.
I'd really like to see Adams thrown in as a site.
Well, that site opened up for fishing after being closed for a number of years, just last week.
Not using that site until down the road in the long term.
No, it was one site we were able to bring on due to its immediate importance for collecting that data. We had access this year to that site, which we did not
have. It's an unfished, it's a relatively unfished place, relatively being important. We actually have some concerns about the fact that that's open to the public theoretically. That could be
that's
a privately owned ranch that WCB and my agency just purchased. That's why it's now
two positions.
Commissioners, if I may, we did hear and discuss your recommendations at the last meeting that prompted us to look at the plan in more detail and really look at the fact that this thing goes into effect the minute it's adopted, and looked at what that does and where we are in terms of our information, and it's resulted at, in us looking at it in a lot more detail and proposing some revisions and delaying. It will cause a delay in our delivering the product to you for adoption, though, based on your recommendations at the last meeting. Because we do want to make sure the plan is clear. We want to make sure that when it's implemented, it goes into effect immediately, and that those effects are what you're after, as opposed to something based on, you know, you're going to, it has decision rules in it, and we want to make sure those decisions are made in a way that that are good both for the resource and the user. So it's going to take us a little more time to incorporate your recommendations. And I take it that's what you wanted us to do, as opposed to just comment on it. Correct.
What, just to sort of add to Deputy Director Mastrop's comments, as I showed in the first page's handout, the document already addressed your concern, and that we recognize that we need additional sites, and we will move towards doing that. That's part of the plan. It's how many sites do you want, and when do you want them to come online? Those are questions that are actually part of the interim management that comes into play once the plan's adopted. We recognized immediately the Storneta Range site as a unique site, and we needed to collect data there, so we've added that to our program. As other sites come up that are part of that, we would do the same thing. However, we haven't even implemented the plan yet, and so it's really difficult to say how far we can jump and where we can go with it until we're there and we're looking at operating under that management plan.
I mean, I don't think that Commissioner Flores wanted just to choose a random number of sites, and I don't think you want us to just throw anything out like, you know, a number. But I think the theme that we tried to create, I think you obviously understand it, and I understand what you're saying back, is that four sites are acknowledged is not enough, but then that's all you have until you start developing these other management plan interim guidelines. We just have to feel comfortable with the fact that the department is looking every place possible to gather as much data as possible, because we're not comfortable with four sites only. But you're saying you're not comfortable with four sites only either. And are you asking us, like, for an exact number?
Well, no, this is where our point of clarity is.
What's the confusion?
When Commissioner Flores asked, will you add more sites and will you, you know, address this in the management plan, and I responded, yes, we will address this in the management plan. And yes, we will add more sites. And yes, we will. The question is, how do we go about that, and where do we do that? Are you asking? My question when we left here afterwards, when we got a memo from the commission, was, okay, now wait, are they asking for a specific number? Are they asking us to change the plan to do that? And if so, we need some kind of a motion so that we know what that is. Otherwise, the document already states we will do that, and we will move forward with developing more sites as we can do that, as we move towards from the interim management into the long-term management.
That's the kind of reassurance I need. I'm not in Florida, but I don't think he wanted the number. He wanted to know that you were looking at the
time. Well, I was trying to get, I want to get them off those traditional sites as soon as possible, immediately, actually, if they could, and looking at some other areas for other relevant data. And so if it's four, it's fine. I mean, if you can get two, I'll be an advocate. But if you get more, that's fine. But I think that the sooner the better.
And
not only for me, but for the public. You know, when I went out to the hearings, that's what I heard from the folks. You know, you guys are going to the same places all the time. Let's take a look at some other sites as well. Pull some data from there. And you have those folks that said, hey, hands up, we'll help you. Just ask us and we'll go out there.
And just so I think I understand what you're asking, you actually want four or at least two in the plan as it's drafted, not in an implementation.
Go ahead and identify two. You've already got this.
All right. That was the confusion, was whether you wanted to modify the existing plan. That's what I thought you wanted.
Yeah, but we don't want to
think.
So again, I think Mike and I are thinking along the same line. We don't want four more just like that. Or that utilize four spots that the Avalon industry and the public can get access.
So what you're saying, just to repeat it, so I make sure, is in the plan, the ARMP plan that we present to you, you want a better plan at collecting information about both the fishery and the populations built into the plan for you to adopt.
Because right now,
whatever that might be,
foremost hammered sites that there are.
All right. I understand it. Do you, Eric?
I do. Do we need a motion to get it?
Yeah. I move that we implement my original recommendations.
I mean, if you don't, but if you want to make it abundantly clear, you can have a motion.
Okay.
We don't need a motion because the plan hasn't been adopted.
Right.
So we don't have to go.
Okay, so we have some clarity of what you want.
Right.
I want to explain why I was unclear about it. In any case, then I also need to explain to you that we're going to have to go back and revise the document, and that the new date that we would bring the document to the commission would be the December hearing.
Okay.
Fine. Thank you.
When you bring it back to the December meeting for adoption, is the department wanting the commission to schedule public testimony at our late August or October meetings, or just wait till December?
We've completed the public testimony portion of it, and this is why I was confused at the last meeting, is that the last meeting was an informational meeting and public testimony meeting before the commission, and therefore Commissioner Flores's comments were handled as if they were a public comment, recognizing him as a commissioner, but we responded to it, which is the last page of the handout I gave you, we responded to it as if it was a public comment, saying, yes, we recognize the document's deficient, we will add more sites. The direction we now have from the commission is to develop the plan so that it contains more sites right off the bat as we implement it. That's fine. We have that direction. We'll do that.
Yeah, we would need more time. Eric, do you know how long it would take us to redraft the plan with their recommendations so that, I'm not sure how much time we need to get to the point where they could then take further testimony on the revision of the plan.
Well, the revision would just be that one revision. I mean, we're doing other editorial revisions, but the one at the point we came last month, after we closed that hearing, we addressed all the public comments in the public comment section. If necessary, we revised the plan based on those comments, and that's contained in the document now. We did not envision having additional public comment or putting out another draft. We would finalize the document and adopt the document, have the commission adopt the document at the December hearing. If the commission wishes to hold additional public hearings, we can do that. It would delay the adoption process, or it being a adaptive management plan, at any point in time, the commission can decide to amend that document as well once it's adopted.
It seems to me that what would satisfy our purposes here would be to continue on the schedule that we're on, which is adoption in December, but ask the department to, at our late August or October meeting, show us the language that you're going to amend into the plan that is responsive to what we're asking for, and if necessary, we can vote on that, or probably just say, this is good, put this in the plan. Is that
work for everybody?
That works.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Why don't we do that at the October meeting?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay.
October.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Mr. Weakland.
Paul, before you get started, you were in here when I talked to the people on the COHO and said, if you're going to be repetitious, we just as soon not hear from you. And I'm going to tell you the same thing. We've heard an awful lot from you. And if you're going to just be repetitious about what we've already heard, I'm going to ask you not. And if you're not going to be repetitious, I'm going to give you 1 minute.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. The Abalone had 26 permanent study sites until 1998. When that was all wiped clean, destroyed documents, because they realized that they outplanted diseased abalones and started an epidemic with withering syndrome. That is when this all started. Rather than take accountability, they've destroyed documents, destroyed their studies, destroyed data. It is appalling. They have had 10 years. Here's a handout. 10 years since the first closures on black abalones. That was in 1993.
Paul, you're being repetitious. We've had this.
We had 26 permanent study sites. In 1999, a document came out criticizing. We criticized in that document the four study sites that were proposed. You act like it's brand new. That's almost 7 years old, saying that four study sites isn't enough. Now your credibility has gone to the dirt again because you had promises of our next meeting in August that this was going to be adopted. If you would answer the public comments that you've had ever since 1993 on the closure of the Black Abalone's, which has not happened, no public comment in over 10 years.
Here's another. So your integrity has just gone down the tube because you promised
your time's up.
That it would be adopted by the next meeting. How many people can show any integrity or
honor?
Item 12 is receipt of commission informational items, subcommittee report on the Marine subcommittee.
thank you, Director Traynor. The Marine subcommittee met in Los Alamitos July 7th, and we will be meeting again on the Wednesday before the late August meeting, I believe. Many of you will be deep sea fishing then, but Marilyn and I will be hard at work, hard at work. We had three issues on our agenda in Los Alamitos. The first was herring with Eric Larson. The department is predicting that their recommendation will be for a pretty pre-reduced fishery in San Francisco Bay when it's time to set those regulations. And we're going to hear a lot about changing the mesh size. The department's likely going to be opposed to making any changes there. We spent most of the meeting talking about the squid fishery management plan, and Marcy and staff field tested on us, Marcy and Dale, I guess, field tested on us document that I will sort of hand up and show you. This is the list of decisions that we will have to make in the process of adopting the Squid FMP, and it is 12 pages long. It's in a format that I think will help in our decision-making process because it's kind of decision by decision. Here are the options. Here's what the department is recommending, and as you go through it, here our recommendation to the department was to organize it in such a way that as we go through it, it's clear in what way our options get narrowed down as early decisions limit the scope of later decisions. But if you haven't already done so, I urge you to take a look at the squid fishery plan because it's really going to be a pretty busy meeting for us when it's time to actually decide what options within the plan we want to adopt. Finally, we had a discussion of redesigning the recreational marine fishing license. You may recall that this was a suggestion that Randy Fry made, which I think the commission said we like that idea. Go ahead and explore it. As it turns out, by the time the subcommittee met, it was almost time to go to print for the new license, and therefore we won't be able to make any changes in the license for this year. The subcommittee recommends, however, that we continue to discuss this because we do have time to make changes in the license before the next printing, which would happen around this time next year. That having been said, there are a lot of interesting sort of survey method questions that have to get ironed out in order to make sure that we get some useful data back from a redesigned license. And of course, that discussion led inevitably back to my favorite topic, ALDS, which should I put Sankey on the spot or not? Yeah, why not? Go ahead, Sankey. Give us a quick little bit.
We even have a letter from NRDC urging.
Yes.
Just a
letter. You mean an update on ALDS?
An update on ALDS, because we talked about it in the subcommittee meeting.
Well, I guess probably the best update I can tell you is we should probably spend a lot of energy looking at this alternate license. Do I need to say more? Seriously, though, the ALDS did get caught up in the CPR
right.
effort. There are also some other issues in terms of legislation that, in a nutshell, I mean, it's going to be a while, I'm afraid. And I think having an alternative, as we discussed at the Marine Subcommittee, is a very good idea.
Right. So, memo to self, we need to take this up early and soon so that we get ahead of the printing schedule.
Is there any way we can help you out with the ALDS? Gosh, every other Rocky Mountain state has it. I mean, it's just incredible that where technology's born in the state, we don't have it. And I don't know what the numbers are in other states in terms of how they understand it. Very fantastic, but geez.
Mr. Flores, you sound Commissioner Flores, you sound like a record of myself on this issue. I agree with you totally. We instituted in February a commitment to get it back on track after the last hiatus. We're going to push hard. I've asked for actually a meeting on this issue with the Department of Finance. We need it not just for service to the recreational hunter and angler, but for our ability to do more effective biological monitoring, for our ability to understand broadly preference and interest of the licensed buyer, and we'll keep pushing it. But at this point, it's been set back a year from where I thought it was in February. We'll keep pushing.
Marilyn, did you want to add anything to that report?
No, I'm on that committee.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll be pushing.
Right. So, like I said, while you guys are deep sea fishing the day before the late August meeting, we'll be working. Not that I want to make you feel guilty about that. Good, thank you. That makes me feel better.
Not you, boo.
Report on the Western, Commissioner Flores.
Oh, I'll let you go. Since you're the professional
of the year.
Thank you. It actually was a very good meeting, as always. It's, I think, beneficial on behalf of the commissioners to try to attend if you can. As Commissioner Flores indicated earlier, that it is good to discuss issues with directors and commissioners of other states. If you look at your plaque, the Western now includes basically every state west of the Mississippi. And that's because the Western is a very active regional association. And states such as Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas wanted to be part of that. And so they've joined. They continue to be with the Midwest region, but they wanted to join an active organization. And the midwinter meeting will be in Coronado in January. I would suggest that you try to attend. I believe it's the 7th, 8th, and 9th of January. And it's not like the annual conference in July. It's the commissioners will have a committee meeting for a day. They meet jointly in the afternoons, usually with the directors for 3 or 4 hours. And then there's a short business meeting on the last day. And so I'd encourage you to attend, since it will be in state. Next July will be in Alberta, Canada. And I believe it's the 21st through the 27th, somewhere in that time frame. So I suggest you put that on your calendars, and we'll work. Just let me know, and we'll put in the out-of-state travel documents needed. But just as an example, the commission met, or commissioners met with the directors the first day for a half a day, and it was on basically, if you remember the commissioner's handbook that was passed out a while back. It went through on how to become an effective commissioner and how to work with your different state directors. Then the commissioners met in the afternoon for 4 hours. You submit state reports, but those state reports talk about the different issues that are going on in each state. And some of those are selected for further discussions in later days. The commissioners met two separate occasions after that for a couple hours to discuss those issues and then prepare for our next meeting. We had two sessions on the Endangered Species Act that was very well attended and handled. We had distinguished speakers such as Craig Manson, who's an undersecretary for Department of Interior, that was there to provide his perspective on the Endangered Species Act and maybe some ideas of how the act can be amended to work better in the field, streamline it, right. Then there's committee meetings that commissioners are welcome to attend, state, federal issues, marine, inland fisheries, mule deer, ad hoc committee, all kinds of activities for you to do. They even provided a day of relaxation for commissioners and directors. Commissioners went on a retreat on a raft trip. Directors got to ride horses in the mountains.
Everybody had their cell phones confiscated.
They didn't work.
Yeah, they didn't work.
Bob and my dad, they also had a seminar on how to be an effective commissioner. And also, what's the other one? How to be a good listener?
Did you make that report?
I did.
Thank you.
And it was very important. It was real interesting because you know, they pulled me together with the guys from Idaho and a few other folks from Washington. And so it was interesting. We had to do a lot of role playing and come up with some ideas. The moderator was very good. Actually, very good. But it was interesting to see how you know, different commissions face different issues, and you know, we're pretty unique here in that some of the other commissions, you know, they appoint the director, so they have a little bit different role, and ours is a little bit different here. So you know, you can sort of talk about how we handle certain things and how the work point is. So it's real interesting. We learned an awful lot.
And it was good to have former Commissioner Mike Chrisman present for part of the time. And
he
also
gave our report.
And he gave the state report. And it was good to have Director Broderick attend also and participate.
Sounds like it is worthwhile.
It's very worthwhile.
It's my second time.
Director Broderick?
Just an observation for the President of the Commission. I didn't get to spend a lot of time there. This was in conjunction with the Pacific Flyway Council, which I'm your one of the junior representative to in the council, and that was on Friday, so there was double duty. What struck me, though, and I know there's a lot of differences between, you would think, Idaho and California, but when you get down to the basics and the fundamentals, all the commissioners and the directors I talked to, it's not an issue of huge differences. It's an issue of dosage, for lack of a better term. Common themes, common interests, common conflicts. And certainly from my perspective, it was nice to realize that we have a lot to learn and a lot to offer both ways. And when you look at the commissions and departments west of the Mississippi, if we had even two or three issues we confronted in a like fashion with a similar view and outlook and objective, it doesn't get any more powerful than that. So that was, I think, the take-home message for me.
Thank you.
Our next item is receipt of federal agencies' informational items, and I've coaxed Mr. Rod McGinnis with NOAA Fisheries to remain for this item and provide a brief update. As commissioners know, Joe Blum represented NOAA Fisheries and provided his insights and updates on NOAA Fisheries activities under this agenda item, and we miss Joe immensely, as I know Mr. McGinnis does too.
Yes. Thank you, commissioners. Thank you, Executive Director Trainer. I have just a few words to say on that, and that's that I am working to get a successor for Joe Blum. The role that Joe played in attending and getting to know the business of this commission and the Board of Forestry and other state agencies is a valuable one to our operation. We all deal with highly complex issues, and in the areas where we overlap, we have enough opportunity for honest disagreement between our agencies and individuals, and it's a heck of a lot easier if we don't have also just accidental misunderstandings. So the more we know about each other's business and how the things that we're facing, I think the more likely we are to be able to resolve the issues that we have in common. So I'm working on filling that. In the meantime, I do have several other leadership positions that have come open or will be open in my own operation over the next year. So the Joe Blum successor is the tops in the leadership position, because this is a critical relationship that we have with the state of California and particularly with this Fish and Game Commission. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item is, apologize for that, receipt of legal counsel informational items. Mr. Cunningham doesn't have any items, but if any commissioner has an item that you'd like Mr. Cunningham to research and bring back to a future meeting, he's willing to do that.
Mr. President, as you know, my time is always available to answer questions.
A lot of things going on at the Alcosha Committee or at the Marine Committee that I'm interested in, and I'm not on either one of those committees because three people make a quorum and we're not allowed to. I go to the meeting, go and listen.
No.
I can't even go.
I'll have to think about it, but usually the problem is the minute you're there.
It already goes.
It's close.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Good opportunity.
But that's why we provide the updates.
I understand.
So we're fully briefed on what the issues were that were discussed.
Oh, I want to go watch you in action over.
Okay.
No, just you guys from Los Alamitos. I was right now.
We were very close to
that. I was going to come down and just hang out and watch. I was told, no, that would be illegal.
Although I might suggest that there's nothing that says we can't go ahead and notice that with an additional notice indicating that there will be three members of the commissioner present.
That doesn't matter, honestly. I trust their report. I was wondering. I heard that in the room it would be illegal, so I was just checking if it is, so I won't go. It's okay.
We'll try.
No, it's okay. Okay.
And again, my offer is, as Mr. Trainer indicated, there are a variety of other general subjects that occasionally might come to the commission's attention, where you may wish to ask your counsel for information about those items or a discussion on those items. And I'm always prepared to bring those to you if you wish, at your request, or if you wish, I can also look at a variety of kind of standard form items and occasionally bring them to you as time permits.
Well, I mean, let me just not belabor it, but they were considering all the squid regulations, the 12 pages of things, 70 recommendations or something, and I'm very interested in that because I'm going to be serving as a hearing officer in San Pedro next week for the squid fishing folks. And so I thought I should go to the Marine Committee meeting and learn more before I went to the hearing officer, but that wasn't allowed. So there was a real purpose, not just to be social.
I'm going to appoint an endangered species task force of one person and appoint you to that.
I second that motion.
No, but you don't. Okay.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Hattori. Thank you, Mr. President. With that, we don't have any further business at this time other than executive session. Do you want to hold it here? Or?
Here's fine.
Okay. We would ask then that the room be cleared so the commission can go into executive session.
Sure.